Good afternoon and welcome to the June meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Today will be our workshop session. We will have a workshop session today. Hopefully we'll complete it today. If not, we'll continue it tomorrow morning before the actual formal session. Let people know that there may be some adjustments to that. We'll know as we get today. The governor will be addressing the CTP tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So he will be here to address us on his planned vision for transportation in the Commonwealth. So that's something to look forward to tomorrow. As custom, would you all please stand and we'll open the meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, and liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we have, looks like we're going to have a lot of numbers to go through this afternoon, guys. Lots of budgets and, this, of course, the big six-year plan and updates on projects. So if you haven't had any caffeine, I'd get some, because I think we're going to be going through quite a bit today. And first up is Mr. Lawson with the Commonwealth Transportation Fund and VDOT budget. I guess Garrett's going to help you out. Certain areas. So, welcome, Mr. Lawson.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. As the Secretary mentioned, I will go through the six-year financial plan, the TTF, and the VDOT budget. At the end of the presentation, there will be a bit of a discussion around the maintenance program and how that budget is distributed and will be put to use, and just talking a little bit about the condition of our infrastructure. And, you know, Chief Engineer Moore will be coming up to speak to that. The six-year financial plan, I usually present this to the board in the January time frame. So for the new members here, the six-year financial plan is the look of all revenues that are forecasted for transportation. This is all modes.
I'm going to interrupt. I meant to say we have some new members, and so today is also meant to give you the global perspective of all the transportation revenues, and then we'll work down. So that's the way it's being presented. So because the six-year plan is just a part of the transportation budget that we do. So that's where we're going to start from the very top. John's going to take us through and work our way down so you know how, when you take the vote, how it works in the budget. So anyway, I should have made it better. Thank you,
sir. So as you're saying, the financial plan includes all the funding that comes in and really is distributed by you to highways, transit, ports, and to aviation. There are formulas that drive those distributions, but it all starts with the financial plan. The 15 through 20 plan is $32.5 billion, so it's a rolling six-year plan. When you compare it to the previous plan, it's about a 2% reduction. That reduction, again, is the result of the drop-off of 14, the addition of 20, and then there's some changes in the use of bond proceeds in the middle that are the biggest driver for the reduction. The six-year financial plan, the basis for it is, we're required by codes to use the most recent revenue forecast provided for the state. Our revenue forecast for the state revenue sources is produced by the Department of Taxation, and the most recent forecast was the December 13 forecast that was done just prior to session. Typically, the General Assembly or a tax will put out a revised forecast post-session that reflects any changes. Since we haven't got to post-session yet, we took and adjusted the December revenue forecast to remove the hybrid license fuel fee that was passed. The removal of that was passed during the session, so we did take that out on our own. Looking at the state revenue outlook, I know you've probably heard where the general fund is looking at some very serious shortfalls looking outward. Things are looking better for transportation. The one source that is of some real concern to us is the state, the revenue, retail sales, which is a little sluggish. But as you can see, we would need revenue in June to meet the 14 forecast. We'd need revenue in June to be about 11%. When I look back a year ago, it was 10.7% of the year. So we're looking very close to coming in. So I'm feeling pretty good about the state revenues from a transportation perspective. In terms of
one point on that, Mr. Wall, we will brief you some throughout the day quickly as to the budget and what impacts it did do to transportation. May ask you to do that at the end. A couple things. So we are impacted, but not nearly as much as other agencies because most of ours are non-general fund revenues in that. But there are some impacts, and we'll point that out. As you know, the budget is on the governor's desk. He has until Sunday to make either amendments or approve it. What he'll do is, you guess as good as mine, he'll determine what the actions will be taken. But there are a few things in there that do impact us, and we'll let John go through those when we go through this presentation in that. So, but the point here is that the story we're seeing out of the general fund revenues being down significantly is not the story on the non-general fund transportation. That could be good or bad, because we have money and they're looking for money in that regard. So John will go through those a little bit later.
As I mentioned earlier, some of the change in our reduction in the year-over-year comparison of the plans, it is related to bond proceeds. We are continuing both of our active bond programs, the capital project revenue bonds, which we refer to as CPR bonds, and the Garvey program, which are federally backed bonds. In 15, there aren't any Garvey plans, so you'll see that when we get into the numbers deeper. And the whole six-year plan that we're looking at, 15 through 20, all of the proposed usage of CPR bonds are to support transit and rail. You've heard, when that authorization was passed in 2007, I guess it was. It was intended to be a 10-year program, $3 billion, with defined percentages of how much would go to highways versus to transit versus rail. With the actions that were done by McDonnell in 2011 to accelerate the program, we fronted, in essence, all of the highway portion of the bonds. So what you have now is the continued use of the transit and rail portions going forward. Federal revenue, we rebased our federal revenues in this plan on 2014 apportionment and obligation authority levels. As you know, 2014 is the last year of MAP 21. There isn't anything beyond that in terms of a forecast. We flatlined it based on that. We're hopeful that that's not an overly optimistic view. But we are working with the Secretary now and trying to do some contingency planning, I'll call it, as we look outward to see what might happen in terms of the federal program.
We will have, and John, we go through the day, plan to go through what those plans would be in terms of how it may impact us, depending on if there's no action by the federal authorities on the trust fund, whether that means we get limited reimbursement or no reimbursement for a period. So we're doing some, go through a few things that may have to come back to you depending on what happens. We should know a lot more in the next 30 days, but it's a lot like an aircraft carrier. In other words, by the time we know we're not going to get it, it may be too late to react. So we may have to, so we're trying to look at what are some prudent things to do that we don't hold up anything in the short term, but make sure we don't get caught if, in fact, something isn't fixed here in August. So we'll go through those later. Just want to let you know we're very much concerned about what may happen.
This slide is the revenue, a summarization of the revenues that are expected over the 6 years. You see it's kind of broken out into three groups. You see at the top the state revenues, highlighted in red, the federal. Again, we just kind of wanted to highlight the federal revenues, which do represent about 18% of the total. And then at the bottom, you see the other financing sources, which are the bond proceeds. So when I look at this revenue sources in total, bond proceeds are really adding about 5% to the program. Which if you look, all the way back up at the top, the HMO, which is the maintenance fund, that represents about 38% of the total. The trust fund is another 23% of the total. So you can kind of see the order of magnitude. And also interesting to note here, you've got nearly 10% of the revenue here is related to the regional programs. You see that right in the just above the local line in the top section, regional transportation funds. That is the Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads components. This just graphically shows you that by order of magnitude, those revenue sources. And you can see that the largest single revenue source, a little small to read, but is the retail sales and use tax. Federal is now second. That change took place with the enactment of 2313. Prior to 2313, federal was first, motor vehicle sales was second, and retail sales was third. So you can see how the changes of 2313 have kind of shifted our reliance more heavily now to retail sales and away from the transportation-specific sources. This schedule shows the anticipated use of the $32.5 billion over the 6 years. These are the major categories by which we distribute the funds, largely listed in order of priority, or at least in order of having to fund them. Debt service is an initial and immediate requirement. Agency transfers is required, mostly outlined in the Appropriation Act. And as you have heard repeatedly, we consider ourselves a maintenance first agency, and therefore it's maintenance and operations comes next. You see down just a little further the distributions to rail and public transportation, port fund and the airport fund, which are statutory requirements of the distribution of the trust fund revenues. And then we have NVTA and Hampton Roads, both listed separately here. Construction really does end up just where you see it. It's at the bottom. Once everything else is funded, what gets left for construction is what's there.
Secretary?
Yes, Mr. Dennis.
A question. John, with that flat line of the federal funds, our response, if they were to be less than that number, will that be just a quid pro quo across the spectrum of all our expenses or all of our revenues and expenses, or is there going to be a specific plan that if it's cut 5%, this is where we're going to go? I mean, I just try to get a feel for that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gorzynski, for the most part, the reductions would follow the federal categories as to where the federal funds are. So majority of the federal program, about almost 60% of that construction line is federal.
Okay.
And then there's about 12% or so of maintenance is federally funded. There is a fairly significant piece of transit and rail that receives federal funds. So that's where the targeted spots are going to end up.
By far, construction, our six-year plan, will be the most impacted, and that includes just about every district in the Commonwealth because the way our federal funds are allocated. So, and we'll go into it later, Gary, but construction, the six-year plan would be hit the hardest. That also, get into crossover and how that impacts a bit. But the point is that these follow the law. We by law are required to maintain the current road system, pay our debt service and all that first. And that's why, the overriding majority of federal funds are in construction in that regard. So,
thank you for clarifying.
Yeah,
certainly. A little busy, but the intent of this chart is just to show the slices of the pie. And the same numbers you saw in total before, but just the slices of the pie. About 38% of the total program is going to maintenance. Really two pieces. You see that in the green, two green slices on the right. You have the VDOT maintenance of just about $9.6 billion, and then the local payments you see there, $2.6 billion. And again, you see the totals here as they relate to the others, and again, that we've highlighted that about 10% or $3.1 billion of the total is related to the region. It's just, in essence, pass-through money to us, from us, to those regions. What I'll do now is just kind of step to the budgets. The two action items that related to the CTF and VDOT budgets that you will be asked to act on tomorrow are the CTF budget, which again, the Commonwealth Transportation Fund is kind of the umbrella fund of all revenues for transportation. So that's two separate budgets. You'll get a budget for that in essence distributes the monies to each of the modes. And then I'll have the VDOT budget and Steve Pittard will present to you the DRPT budget. In essence, the 15 budget is just the first year off that six-year plan. So the numbers will all look very similar. The percentages, again, will be all very similar. The budget for the CTF is $4.9 billion, which is a little over 5% down from 14. And again, that's largely due to bonds. There was significantly more bonds programmed in 14 than there is in 15. In terms of the uses of those funds, again, it follows the same pattern you were seeing before. Maintenance is still 39% of the total, the largest. About 23% of the total is what it's flowing through to construction. You can see that transit and rail is just over 10%. Again, we've already talked about the regions. From a VDOT perspective, the budget is $4.3 billion, which is about 6%, almost 7% down from the previous year. There are no bond proceeds forecast in VDOT's budget for 2015. We did have bonds in 14. Again, the bonds that we're selling in 15 are related to transit. There is revenue by way of the 2313 increases that will allow for some construction money to be distributed to the CTB formula. It's about $160 million is what's going through the formula in 15. And the majority of the revenues that do support transportation, as the Secretary mentioned, are dedicated revenues. We get very small amount of general funds, and I know you've heard of the term crossover referred to. Crossover is when the revenues of the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund are insufficient to cover the needs of the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, and it requires a transfer, or crossover, that the name was coined, of state construction money to over into the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund in order to meet the needs. So in 2015, there's $300 million of revenues that are directed to the construction program, construction fund, that will have to be transferred to Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund to address maintenance needs.
We had hoped that House Bill 2313 would have eliminated that. I think the original projections were like in 17.
Correct.
But because at the last meeting we reported that the John went over a little earlier, the reductions in revenues based on the current projections from last year, that now looks like it's going to continue into the year 2020 or beyond. So that is something that we're hoping to eliminate, but unless that economic activity picks up, that's going to continue to curtail some funds that we have for construction to meet our mandatory guidelines and maintenance.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. This chart is a little busy, but the intent of it is to try to help explain the some of the complexities and the way the different fund sources are utilized across the programs. The splits you see, just looking at the top line, sales tax on motor fuels. The split you see between the highway maintenance and operating fund and the construction fund are code-driven. It's not air choice. It's the way that the code directs the monies to be used. And that is that really started with the 86th special session when they created the Transportation Trust Fund and said, in essence, all the new revenues that were generated by the TT by the 86th special session were dedicated to the construction fund. And that's the piece, and you see down at the bottom, next to the bottom line, the $300 million that we're having to transfer back over to the HMO. This is VDOT's budget based on the program. And these are the official budgetary programs of the Commonwealth that you would see if you look in the budget bill or the Appropriation Act. We showed here, because we did do a revised budget, we showed what the original was versus the revised budget, and then the comparison to 2015. As you recall, that we did a revised budget and increasing the maintenance program by $92 million to help address the significant and unexpected snow costs that we had this year. Just summarizing, you see here from the budget the revenues that we anticipate to collect how we plan to use those revenues. You'll see, and the Chief Engineer will be speaking more to the importance and the focus of our funds on the rehabilitation and maintenance of our existing assets. The Commissioner will be speaking to you shortly about the construction program, 6-year program, and I'll give you a little more information around that. As you would expect, almost didn't put it up there because it should go without saying, we do continue to very carefully constrain our administrative programs. Admin doesn't put pavement on the road, but we got to make sure we have people to pay the bills for the person that put the pavement on the road. So I think do a very good job of constraining that item. And as we've talked, the revenue outlook remains a significant concern, especially in terms of the federal program. Before we get into the maintenance piece, did you want me to just speak to Secretary about the enrolled bill?
Sure, yeah.
There were a few items in the enrolled bill that are not incorporated in this budget. Obviously, the enrolled bill is not law yet. But the few things that we're watching is language directing us to fund or provide $5.8 million for the construction of a taxiway, runway on Wallace to support the unmanned drone study. There is up to $6.2 million to go toward the design and engineering, I think, of dredging for the port. They have also are looking to, I call it, borrow some money from us. There's language where they would take $30 million of highway maintenance and operating fund cash sometime during fiscal year 15 and return it in fiscal year 16. And lastly, there is a bill, as is an amendment, that would take just over $31 million from the trust fund that relates to some unspent balances that were related to allocations provided to through the 2007 Transportation Initiative related to the Transportation Partnership Opportunity Fund. We had asked for those revenues to be released because we completed the projects. So we was looking to have the revenues released from the TPOF program to support the general program. And what they have done is actually in the enrolled language, they're taking an equal amount of money. They did not release the TPOF funds, but they're taking an equal amount of money out of the trust fund. So that one, even in its intent, I think came out a little awkward. So that's what we're looking at in terms of the enrolled bill. And as the Secretary mentioned, it's on the governor's desk. And once it is acted on, obviously we will have to take, likely have to take action here to make, reflect those adjustments.
We're hopeful that the borrowed funds that John spoke to, we're not sure if that's really a cash flow loan or they just need it for one day to balance the budget. We're working through that with them, in that regard. And we think the language on the TPOP, the Transportation Opportunity Fund, is just, it can get fixed. It was not their intent, but that's the way it came out in there. So hopefully get those. But, and if we're able to, works out the way we think, then the Bureau shouldn't be any significant changes to our plan. But if it doesn't, then we got to deal with $60 million, then we'll have to come back and say we're going to have to do a few things a little different. We did have a few, well, we haven't got to the Charlie and Jennifer of the six-year plan, but there were a few changes from the plan you saw based on some of the considerations that came down from the negotiations on the budget and that. So we'll go through those when we talk to them, when we get to it. Yes, sir. Cole.
Mr. Lawson, one question on slide 15, the administrative and support services, showing what looks to be an 11 or 12% increase. Was that driven by a particular factor, or is that just overall inflation that you're looking at?
Yeah, well Mr. Secretary, Mr. Cole, first off, you really need to compare it to the original, because we did scrape it to get some money to contribute to the maintenance costs. And the second piece of it is it's mostly increases in some IT costs related to the Cardinal application and a couple other things. So there, it's not what I would call general administration. It's specific IT infrastructure.
Thank you.
Oh, hello, Mr. Moore. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Good, sir. Thank you. For the newer members of the board, this is a series of goals that is given to the department and approved by the board generally annually. And this is our pavement and bridges, the basics of what we do. To give you a little history, probably 5 years ago, we were running out of cash. We had a bond actions that were taken, and we've put a lot more into maintenance. We're probably paving $200 million a year. Now it's about $500 million if you flatten it out. But we had a degrading system. So we've set goals so that we can correct that degrading system. As the Secretary had said earlier, that doesn't change overnight. It's more like steering a large ship. And so we're trying to forecast the future and also hit these goals. The other thing that we need to do in the department in executing your goals is we will send these to the districts, and the districts that you represent will then execute basically the way that we're told. So one of the things that happened last year is these goals have generally remained the same, but if you look down at the one sub-bullet there that says no section of interstate pavement with a CCI, and that's a combined condition index. It's a rating that we make less than 30, and that means a failing pavement. Because what we had done with the bullet above that is said we want everything fair or better, So the district's doing what they told, got everything fair or better, but they left some in moving resources around. And about a little over a year ago when I first came to this job, I found myself down in Hampton Roads, and we were losing tens of miles of interstate. So that's the state that it got to. We are now recovering that. We have other sections of interstate we think we are getting ahead of, but right now we're trying to put space between ourselves and the risk in some of these areas, and that's why I wanted to take a little time to talk about it. And your district administrators can brief you if you want more detail on these things. The other one that is a newer goal down there is the 65% of secondary pavements being fair or better. That's a newer goal as well. The percent of bridges has been the same for quite a while. And these were established a few years back as what I would call resource constrained goals. If you were to ask me, are these where we should be? I'd say they're good interim steps. We may want to reevaluate against our resources in the future, but for now, until we achieve all these, they're something, a target to go for. So if we talk about where our pavements are, and we...
Mr. Wilmot,
you don't see the goals, but like the question, where are we today with regard to these goals?
The next slide will take us right there. Is that... this shows the annual by from 2010 to 2014 where we are. And you can see statewide that we're on the interstate, we're exceeding. Primary, we believe, and the 14 years are a projection. And what we do is, and I got to be careful with that because we go back and we check those, but given the resources and what we've done, where we believe we'll be. But you can see the increases in there, and essentially for interstate and primary, we are meeting those goals. I'm not showing the CCI 30. We're not there yet. We have work underway, and it will be 2 or 3 years, we believe, before we meet or exceed those goals. A couple of things to note in my view on this slide is if you go to the right, you'll see that the secondary pavements continue to degrade. Most of the traffic in the state is in the left two columns there, the primary and the interstate roads. If you go to Northern Virginia, however, secondaries oftentimes carry more than interstate. So there's other details in here, but two things have happened. We're putting more into paving, but one of the other things that's happening is because there's a lower goal and we didn't have a goal for secondaries, we robbed from the secondaries to keep the spine of the system up. So those are two things that sometimes this can present a better picture than really is out there. So I wanted to kind of talk about those. And again, your DAs can kind of go through that in detail in your district and how the numbers look within your district. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Garrett, so what you're saying is that right now we're chasing the rabbit on the secondaries. I mean, we're behind. But your goal is to take 58% right now and get it back to 65 in 1 year?
That's the goal.
That's
and
a
we're
pretty
doing,
ambitious goal.
And not, we're,
no, not in 1 year.
Oh, not in 1 year.
No, over the coming...
Over the
course of the
plan. Yeah.
Plan.
Next 4 to 5 years. And there's some... There's some struggles to do that. We are scurrying to try to shift, play whack-a-mole with the funds to get there. And one of the keys to it is we know that particularly in Northern Virginia, we've sacrificed the secondaries to pay for the statewide system. So we know that we're going to have to get something in there, or we are at risk of losing major secondaries up there like happened to 64 and 264.
Right. So when we have that new... website where you can
go check on our
secondary road,
which we'll get a chance to look at later.
Yeah. But
Mr. Secretary, yes. Garrett, over the last 10, 15 years, are you seeing a change in the distribution of the traffic? Are one of these sectors growing more than another? I would think with the demographic changes, we're seeing that we might see a shift to primary, secondary.
To answer that question accurately, I'd have to take that back and talk our traffic. We do real-time traffic counts, and that's something I don't feel I have an accurate answer off the... I have not seen a shift. There have been, I know of some shifts that have happened in types of travel, but I'd really like to take that back and get the most current on that. So, yeah, sir.
I should have been more definitive, I guess. Our goal is to talk in terms of each district. And so my question really is, where are we with regard to each district? realize these have to ask your administrator, but do we not have that?
Most of the districts in the latest evaluations are meeting the interstate and primary goals. Two districts have been short on the goals prior to the CCI 30, and those are Richmond and Northern Virginia, although they've gotten closer. The secondaries within Northern Virginia and with the new CCI 30 goal, Richmond District, once Hampton Roads is done with their I-64 and 264, we should be getting closer to meeting those. But the original 82% goal in interstate primary, most districts with those exceptions are meeting them. I can get that information to go district by district.
I just think that's important because that helps to explain why we may have to fund more in one particular district than another to get up to these goals.
It is, and that's how we reallocate resources in the maintenance budget. And part of what we're doing, like I said, is moving money to get the worst need and then moving it over to another district to try and build some space between the risk and us.
Mr. Whitworth, we have we will provide to all the members district by district in terms of pavement conditions in all three systems as well as the bridge. We also track it on our dashboards that's available online, and this is our pavement and bridge condition along with on time and on budget are really our core performance measures that we look at every month in determining how we're doing. Are we delivering projects on time and on budget? And are our pavement conditions, although pavement condition doesn't change monthly, it changes annually. That's the other kind of fundamental area for the department. So we'll make sure that we provide that. We actually have a chart, a scorecard, for lack of a better term, that shows red and green as to whether or not a particular district is meeting target on one of those particular areas. And what we'll do is, that's updated monthly, we'll provide that to you so that you have I see a copy there, so you have a ready copy of where things stand.
I think it's a helpful.
Yeah, remember, they're based on the overall planning, which are quarters of statewide significance. So we start in the quarter, and then we allocate the primaries in the interstates, and we move down. And a few years ago, we were in exactly the opposite situation. The secondaries were getting overly done, and we were just getting killed in interstates and primaries. So it may be something as the board goes forward, as we look at, we now have monies to allocate. But guys, remember, the monies only started coming in last July. We're making up for about 20 years of really not doing a lot here. So that's why it is a little bit, you use whack-a-mole, we sort of go from one to the other. The other thing I would suggest to you, we're not required, but we may want to consider after we get through how we prioritize construction, we may want to go to how do we prioritize maintenance. But that's down the road, and so I'm just saying is we're in the beginning stages of a process that we started a few years ago, basically because the interstates and primaries were falling apart, literally. Yes, the secondaries need to be looked, but now we've got to start working through that. So that's how we got here. It's really something that happened over the last two decades.
And just a couple of notes. On this in particular, the bridges that I'll talk about is more current.
Right.
Just because you have a paving season and we go out on the interstates and primaries and do pretty much 100% check, the secondaries are done 20% each year, so every 5 years. So there is some lag in some of this information, typically even in the interstate and primary, because of you go out and pay for a year, then you check it, it's about a 9 to 18 month lag in the information you get. So it's very slow turning. You got to keep your finger on it all the time, though. And that, I don't know if that's helpful as well. The other one that is, this is our bridges. It's a 92% that are not structurally deficient. And structurally deficient is a scale from 0 to 9. It's a federal and FHWA scale. And once you get to a 5, you're fair. Once you get to a 4, it has a structural issue with it. We don't consider it unsafe, but I would say to have a well-maintained bridge, it needs to be 5 or better. We've made significant progress. The districts have done very well on this. The caveat on this is they've done it on the easy bridges first. We've got the hard ones. Our interstate is 50 to 60 years old. We're at the cusp of the design life. We're not going to be able to afford to replace them inside, so we're going to have to do some innovative things inside. Let's make sure we're getting the funding in the right place. We've made some very good progress. Even in the last month, a couple of districts, one that was doing very well, hit a little hiccup, and we watch this all the time as well. I really think the department's done well. We rank about 19th when you look in bridges, and we'd like to be up where some of the states are doing much better in a well-maintained system. So we're trying to recover this over time. We're continuing to evaluate it, but we have made progress, even when funds were tight. And part of that, I think, was looking at our designs and doing those basic things just to keep the bridges and use the best out of the dollars that we could.
One thing here, you know, this is also in the CTV formula. We set aside monies for bridges coming out of off the top. And Chief Engineer will tell you, we started with a lot of the low-hanging fruit, you know, to get some things done pretty quickly. Some of these are going, a lot of them are going to be very expensive to get up to speed. And that, you know, trying to get the numbers turned, you start working, but we've got our work cut out to get these bridges up to speed.
And just as a note that kind of demonstrates, if you go to the last two bullets down there, we have 56 bridges, 3 culverts on the interstate alone that are currently related to deficient. Only 19 of those are in the 6-year plan. So we've got to do something both with getting resources on them and try to do them in a cheaper way, whether it's preserve as much as we can underneath, to get these in a better condition, because we shouldn't have any of these on the interstate that are deficient. There are some that you can write, but it's cheaper to maintain a well-maintained system than rebuild a degrading system, and that's what we're trying to slowly, or as fast as we can with the resources we have, get there.
And let me point out, deficient does not mean unsafe. If they're unsafe, they close them. So these are safe bridges, but if we don't get on them, they're going to get to a condition where we can't. So I want to make sure that we don't want any deficient. We want to make the public understand all of them are safe, but we're trying to be proactive to keep them from being unsafe down there.
So deficient, is that
It's a general condition rating of 5 is fair. That is not strict. Once it goes to a 4, then it becomes deficient. And any port, there's major portions of a bridge, the deck, the superstructure, beams and stuff, and then the substructure, piers and abutments. If any one of those 3 things is deficient, then the whole bridge is. So sometimes when it says that, we can go the full range from minor repairs to a full rebuild. And what we then do is an evaluation of how do we get it out of there and get as much more service life as we can. But it could be a very minor thing all the way up to a full rebuild.
So on the scale, when does the bridge, when is it considered?
Typically when it gets around 2-1, 0 is closed. So and we don't like them to get that low. One of the things that we have done in the past that we're trying to avoid, and we're still doing but less often, is closing bridges that are unsafe. Our goal would be to never get to that point, even if it gets structurally deficient, get to the point where you get it, because we spend the money to put this capital investment in there for the public. If we're closing it basically because we haven't maintained it, I just don't think that's a good use of our capital investment. So we're trying to get away from those things that were happening 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yes, sir.
Tom. Just trying to get an understanding what we may be facing. Almost 12,000 bridges. How many of them are 5, 6? In other words, is there a way of coming in and have bigger issues?
Well, I can tell you that 92% of them, or 93% of them, are 5 or better. If it's brand new, it's a 9. I can get you the breakdown. I don't have that available right now. You've hit a pretty good point. I don't think it's quite that high, but typically we start looking when they're 5 because they can slip very quickly into a 4. Once they start getting to 6-5, we know that there's something going on, and we're watching those, and that's where preventive maintenance comes in. And there is, I'd say there is, just off the top of my head, there is a larger number that's 5 than 9s just because of the ages of the structure.
I recall 36 months ago, the direction of VDOT was how we were going to close bridges, because there was no 2013 on the horizon. So it's really only been the last 24 months, actually about that time where they've really changed and have been able to put some resources on them.
Sure.
And that, because we were, that was the direction. No money, close the bridges. Yeah, so.
This is a very simple question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How often are bridges evaluated? Like, how often do you make that review?
Minimum of every 2 years. If one is structurally deficient or has some other issue, they're evaluated less than that, sometimes a year, sometimes 6 months, sometimes more. That would be rare, but minimum of 2 years. The other issue that's not on there is one of the things we've been doing is there's, you may read about the present, something called fractured critical bridges, and we've replaced about 15% of those. We think in the next 6 years we'll replace about another 15%. And those are bridges that don't have, they're very efficient bridges, generally built years ago, that don't have redundancy. If one member fails, piece of the bridge, a key piece fails, the whole thing can. We've been replacing those systematically out. So we're trying to reduce risk, and that's, it kind of is invisible to you all, but there are things we're doing, and probably the better way to, if people want to be briefed on it, is to take you individually or as a group and show you over a board what we're, or on a table what we're doing. That might probably would be more conducive to go, and happy to do that. Yes, sir. This is a breakdown of the paving for the next 6 years. You can see it's done both out of the construction and the maintenance budget. Typically in the construction budget, we have done rehabs, the 264 work. There's some rehab on 295, I-85 south of here where we're at risk of losing the interstate there. So we are doing work out of both budgets, and our finance folks are working this to try to get it as even as we can. But what we did when 2313 passed is we brought a lot of this work forward so we could get some of those failing highways funded first. And that's why some of that work is underway, or most of it is actually underway on the rehabs right now. So we are doing it out of both budgets. Average is about $500 million a year. And compared to the $200 million a year 5 years ago, it's much better. And we're going back to look also to sweep the corners, because we think we need to, you know, as money, if we get spare money available, to have projects so that we can build some space between us and the risk on some of these roads that are in poor condition.
Mr.
Cassidy. Yes, sir.
Looking at the decline in secondary roads over the past 4 years, almost 9%, and the allocation for funding paving over the next 6 years, does that actually address the requirement to bring that up? 65% or greater.
We're evaluating that right now. My suspicion is that we're going to need to do more, and we've got some hat tricks to try and get some more resources as it comes available. So I think we need to jump on it, particularly in those urban areas, those type of, if you go out into a rural area, you can skin patch it with a surface tree, very relatively cheap to do. If you go onto a high volume road, sometimes you almost have to go down deep into the base to fix it. So those are the more expensive. Yes,
this is a question.
To answer your question, we haven't finished our evaluation. We do believe it's going to take more.
But you can see it's pretty steady, $200 million a year trying to chip away at it. In other words, not like we were before, going up and down, just steady going at it in the secondary, which is the most significant over the next 6 years of any coming away from interstate and primary.
And some of this may be shifting off interstate, or if we make some headway on the bridges, just our resource. The other, we're looking at some of our other things that we do with maintenance to see, okay, where's the higher need? So we are working to see what we can sweep into there. Plan funding for bridges, again, gives you, it's both construction and maintenance. One of the things that we're finding, the districts that have had some of the best success with improving their numbers, preventive maintenance has been a key, and part of that is how they do the bridge decks and some other things. So both in reconstruction, it takes everything from reconstruction, rehabilitation, all the way to some serious preventive maintenance. Simple things like washing after the winter and making sure you get the corrosion away. Those are things that help. Making sure decks are patched so salt doesn't get to the steel. Those simple types of things have a big impact on what we do. So we're working to try to get the money to all the right places there. This is our proposed budget by system. It's not something that I look at a lot. I mean, it's nice to know, but it's not, I'm more looking at the particular assets within them to see that we're doing the right things, but it does give you a general breakdown. One of the things you'll notice up there between April and June on the FY 2014 is you've got a higher number in April. And those of you that weren't here when we had the discussions about the winter, we did have to move administrative and construction dollars into the maintenance budget because of the severe snow season, and that's what that reflects. And again, you'll see by district, and what you'll see, again, where we put the numbers for the snow was in the statewide programs. It didn't go to central office studies. It was put in a central, rather than the distributions out to the districts, it was easier to show there. So that's what you're seeing in the 225 is some of the snow plus up. And then you can see that that's actually a higher number than 2015. And we hope that we don't see a winter like this last one for at least a few more years, because I'd like to put that money on bridges and pavements if we're fortunate enough to do that. But something we had to do and kept our economy moving, some of the estimates we have in some regions is if you lose a day's travel in commerce, you're losing $100 to $300 to $400 million in commerce. So it's an important thing to do, but if the weather helps us, we'd rather put it on pavements and bridges. These are the proposed budgets again coming up, and payments to localities, and again, rough numbers there. And you can see that with the payments to localities, the total number gets up to about almost $2 billion. And this is required by code for us to put up there. This is a projection based on a model. So I would put that out that these things can be very precise in their number, but they're not necessarily accurate if they're a ballpark number. And what we do is use these to see, are we getting close to where we should be? The number, the projection, the primary has us below our goal, so we're working on these things now to try and adjust those. And bridges and culverts, we are above our goal, but we're going to continue to try and improve there. So this kind of, I would use this as an in the ballpark kind of thing. We're required to do it, but we can't predict the weather. We would like to beat these and use the resources the best way we can if we can beat those next year, and we'll track that and see if we can do it. So, but it is it's a forecast. That's all I have. Any questions?
Okay. Any questions for Chief Engineer?
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Thank you very much. Okay. We have Mr. Pedderton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to spend a few moments today talking about the DRPT 15 annual budget, which y'all will be voting on tomorrow for approval. And as Mr. Lawson pointed out, there are some things in the State Appropriation Act budget that may have an impact, and if they do, we'll come back and do amendments later. Y'all should have gotten this report in your board package, and this is what I'm talking about. And I don't know if you had a chance to read it or not. If you did, at the end I'll gladly answer any questions. But this does provide some good background on all of our different programs and the way our funding is distributed, like particularly in our transit funds between capital and operating. But if you get a chance, it'd be good to read good background information about our agency. With that, I guess the first slide, I just wanted to talk about the basis of development for our budget. And essentially, our budget is done on a cash outlay basis. So it's the money we're going to actually expend for 2015. And I think it's important to note you also have a six-year program, which you're going to be hearing about later from Director Mitchell. And tomorrow we'll be making action on a six-year program. The six-year program takes the current year revenue estimates and allocates those revenues to projects. The budget is saying, okay, we have a lot of projects that extend over numerous years. How much are we going to actually spend of those 2,000 or 3,000 open projects that the agency has, how much are we going to spend in 15? And it notes here at the bottom some of the big differences there. You know, in the six-year program, y'all actually make allocations of federal funds that then our grant recipients, some of our transit operators, they receive those federal funds directly from the Federal Transit Administration, as opposed to those funds flowing through our agency. So that's one of the bigger differences. And I'm not going to go through all the difference. The next slide essentially breaks out those major components and reconciles the six-year program to this budget document for 15. The next slide, I guess, 415, our budget is $584 million. It's projected or estimated to be that. And this slide basically shows you all the main sources of funding that will pay for that $584 million. And a lot of this is flowing from John's presentation earlier. But the Transportation Trust Fund being the largest source, and then from there, as John mentioned earlier, on the bond proceeds, our department did elect to take those bond proceeds over a 10-year period rather than front-loading them in the first 3 years. So we have until 2018, and then that's when those bonds, the 10-year period begins to end. So those are the two largest sources, and that's not really the focus of my presentation, but it does give you a flavor for where the funding comes from. The next slide, next chart, it takes our budget, the $584 million, and breaks it down into service area or program, as Mr. Lawson referred to earlier, which is the Appropriation Act terminology. So this is taking that number and saying, if you were looking at our Appropriation Act programs, these are the different areas where our expenditures occur. And the two largest, obviously, are public transportation. It's a little deceiving there because that's broken down into sub-programs of operating, capital, and special. But then you have several rail programs and then several smaller programs in commuter assistance, human service, and then planning, regulation, and safety, and then, of course, our operating budget. The next slide is comparing last year's budget to this year, so just giving you a comparative. And overall, it has increased, and what that is, as mentioned earlier, is the revenues. I think, Mr. Secretary, you said this, the revenues from HB 2313 are starting to work their way through our capital program, and that's basically what the increase is in the public transportation program. Rail and other programs is pretty much flat, and then I'll talk about the operating budget later. So on our public transportation programs, 2 points to note. The capital program I just mentioned, we had revenues last year from 2313, which we had to develop for the members that were here. We had to develop a whole new allocation process for both operating and capital. And for capital, essentially we set a matching percentage for our program. So last year's funds from 2313, we proactively decided that we weren't going to allocate them until 15. So we have the new revenues from 14 plus the new revenues for 15 in capital, and that's why we have that increase. Also wanted to note operating assistance pretty much flat year over year, and that just leads to these next charts, which is really just some history on the operating side. And what this is really getting at is it shows that over the last 7 years, we have had two different increases to revenues dedicated to transit operations. First, the recordation tax back in 08, and then with 2313, we obviously got new funding to the Transportation Trust Fund, which flows to operating, 72% of it does. And this chart basically shows the impact of those new sources and where we would be without those new sources. And really, in summary, what it's showing is we've just been able to maintain about a 20% share despite those increases. And that's really because of the next slide, because our needs are increasing as transit's become a bigger part of a multimodal solution in the Commonwealth. And with that, the last slide I really wanted to touch on was the administrative budget, because it did increase close to the percentage, Mr. Cole, you pointed out earlier, around 10%. And a large part of that is healthcare costs, and then We are looking to, because we have increased our budget so much in the last 4 or 5 years, it's gone from around $350 million to $550 million. We are looking to potentially add three positions to go from 47 to 50 positions in the agency. So there's some increased payroll and benefits. That's the majority of the increase. And then just other overhead costs and some consulting costs for increases and make up that $1 million. But overall, our whole project management, project compliance, and overhead or typical administrative cost adds up to 1.9% of our budget. And finally, in the current year, it's important to note that with 2313, prior to that, VDOT did take $5 million of highway maintenance and operating funds to support our operating budget. And with 2313 and the increase in funding that we got, it was decided that we could take the funding from those state revenue sources to fund our own overhead administrative costs. And with that, I'll gladly entertain any questions.
Just one thing I should point out, I know there's some questions on the administration in the VDOT budget too, but there are no salary increases in these administrative budgets. Had the General Assembly done so, then we may have come and recommended the same, obviously, but there was none in the general budget, nor are there any in here in that regard. So they're pretty, all you see is pretty much what was last year, which is some cost that we can't control in that. Mr. Pitter, can you explain the marketplace, what Equity Act, that's not in any of these numbers, but it would benefit your department if it does get passed by Congress?
Yes, essentially it's the sales tax on internet transactions. And when 2313 was passed, there was a provision that if the federal government approved that that tax provision, that then the state would be able to collect those taxes. And I think the revenue source was dedicated to the Transportation Trust Fund, and transit receives 14.7% of that revenue source, which for transit in particular, it would amount to about $20 million, give or take a little bit, a year annually, which is a sizable amount of money for transit. Unfortunately, the provision, if the Marketplace Fairness Act was not passed, there was no provision to replace that funding. There was provision, I believe, and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but to replace that funding, I think, in the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund, which doesn't flow to transit or rail.
That's right. So in other words, if we were to get the Equity Act, Fairness Act, it would help, whereas we protected the way the state law works, it converts over, and so we're not losing anything on the highway side, but it would be a great benefit to our rail side if we were done. There's no indication it's going to be passed, but to the extent it does, it would be a hit of $20 million a year to rail, which is substantial to their budget. So, but we've not projected that in any of these plans going out.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Appreciate
it. Thank you, Mr. Pitter. Uh-oh, a big gun's coming up, huh?
You mean Jennifer?
You're up. Okay, so we got Mr. Kilpatrick and Ms. Mitchell for the six-year improvement plan. Just wanted you to see how they fit into the whole budget, the six-year improvement plan is where it comes from.
Chairman Lane, members of the CTV, Commissioner Kilpatrick and I are here to present the final FY15 to FY20 six-year improvement program. I'm going to start out with just a few slides. Charlie's going to talk a little bit about the highway program, and then I'll follow up with some additional details about the transit and rail portion of the program as well. So just as a reminder, and for those of you that are new members as well, the six-year plan must be adopted by the CTV by July 1st of each year, based on the most recent official revenue forecast. This is the program that allocates state and federal funding across the highway system, as well as for transit and rail and transportation demand management programs. It does not include the allocations, as Mr. Lawson has alluded to before, does not include the allocations for the state-funded highway maintenance and operations, funds that go to other agencies, and also administration and other programs. So this year, as I think many of you know, we had hearings in each of the 9 construction districts. I believe that many of you were there for the hearings that were in your districts as well. It was attended by the secretary as well as Commissioner Kilpatrick and myself and the deputy secretaries as well. And I know that we received quite a bit of feedback on both the program but also the level of attendance there, and I think it was quite favorably received by members of the public as well. We had about 400 people attending all 9 hearings. We had 170 oral comments, and then in addition, we received 1,450 written comments as well.
So a couple things regarding policy guidance. First is the maintenance of existing transportation assets. It's a top priority in the budgeting, and again, that's reflected in our overall budget. Also, the maximization of the use of federal funds. One of the requirements of federal funds is that federal fiscal year is October 1 to September 30th. We go through a process of obligating the federal dollars over the fiscal year. If we don't obligate, in other words, we don't commit to fund, move, put it on projects that are actually either in design or they're in the right-of-way phase or in construction, we have the potential of losing that money. Over the last several years, we've benefited from being able to obligate fully our federal funds through a process called bonus allocations, which come from other states that don't meet their needs. That's just something to be aware of. We're very careful to make sure that we always obligate and maximize the use of the federal funds. A couple important points here. House Bill 2 requires in 2016 that most of the expansion or capacity projects that we have in Virginia will go through a prioritization process. We are working along with Deputy Secretary Donahue on moving forward and what that will look like. We'll be working with the board and making presentations throughout the rest of the year. That process must be in place by, again, July 1, 2016, but we've begun work on that now. Additionally, in terms
while we're talking about that, I think, see Mr. Donahue over there, I think at the next meeting you're going to be presenting a sort of an action plan on House Bill 2.
Yes.
Yes, so in July, at the next meeting, he's been working diligently, working out a plan, so we'll present to you how, potentially we'll be working through this implementation. So just want to let before you moved off that, Mr. Kilpatrick.
Secretary.
Yes.
One question. Commissioner, on the 6-year plan as it's produced, with the mention of HB2, there is going to be potentially, or in reality, a gap on PE projects, etc., until this process is adapted. Is that reflected in the plan where possibly PE money or construction money that couldn't be spent because of HB2 could flip for 1 year maybe into more maintenance money?
What we've been, and that is a challenge because you're going from a program as it has evolved over a number of years and projects have been placed on there, some fully funded and some that are not fully funded. With House Bill 2, where we go through a prioritization process, there's potentially some disruption, and we're very conscious of that in terms of making sure that the engineering work, the right-of-way work that we are doing today and into this upcoming fiscal year is work that we have there's a high likelihood that it will not be disrupted. In other words, a project that we're working on today is a project we will be working on after it goes to prioritization. Now, in terms of prioritization, the program this upcoming year is a little less than $1.2 billion in construction. We think only a portion of that will go through prioritization. Because prioritization, there's a number of things that do not go through prioritization, or at least are not prioritized the way it's outlined in House Bill 2. Maintenance project, and what I'll call capital rehabilitation, pavements and bridges, where we're doing major repairs to those assets, safety-related projects. I'll still use the old term, the enhancement program. There's a transportation alternatives program, which are those small grants to localities. Revenue sharing is another example that does not go through prioritization. As the Secretary has mentioned before, the notion there, of course, is that if a local government is going to put up half the money to a project, it's clearly a priority in terms of, and there should be some deference to that in terms of project delivery. So what we're working to do is to ensure that the engineering work we're doing is not, I guess there's no other way, just a throwaway, that we're not working on projects that are getting ready to, could potentially be reach a dead end. Not that they're not a valuable project, but they may just not rise to the level of the funds available through the prioritization process. So it's a bit of we're making adjustments on the fly, because the other thing that we do not want to do is create a year, 2 years, 3 years of dead space where we don't have projects available because we said stop all engines while we work on this. We just can't afford to do that.
Well, that's what I was getting at, whether that bubble would be there, because in reality, once you go through the process, it's not going to be effective until FY 2018, the way I look at it. I mean, we have the process in 16. What has to go through it takes a year to go through, and then you're at FY 2018.
Yeah. But
is that right, Nick? I mean...
So we're cognizant of that, and while we're on this topic, and you know, one of the things, and Nick's mentioned this before too in his presentations, you know, we'll look at this CTV formula, how we're taking monies off the top, and how that's all going to have to be looked at too, so that exactly to your point, Mr. Karzynski, we are not developing a void of money, because the issue is not to set a bunch of money over the side and not use it. It's quite the opposite. So, but to point now, whether or not that goes to maintenance, I think that's pretty much we got to do that off the top anyway, and that gets back to the crossover.
Right.
And how far we want to push that, we'll just be pulling more monies out before we even start in the construction in that. But you're right, we do not want to end up in for 18 months just have a bunch of money sitting around and nothing's happening. Well, that's not the intent of 2313 nor of House Bill 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
In terms of the program today, 33-123-1, provided that the Commonwealth Transportation Board could allocate up to $500 million each year towards these categories, and we have been, I will tell you that the number is not $500 million in this year. I think the available money is about $300 million. I'm sorry, $160 this year. That gets distributed through this formula here for bridge reconstruction and rehabilitation, pavements, high priority projects, and again, you can go through the list. One change to this, effective with this session of the General Assembly, is changing the category of unpaved road eligibility from 250 cars a day minimum to 50. That coincides with a longstanding provision of the code that In order for a road to be eligible to be, an unpaved road to be eligible to be paved, it had to carry at least 50 vehicles a day. And that's been in place for decades now. The next point going down is really talking about, we've got to look moving forward at how do we provide additional assistance and the ability for local transportation projects and projects of a more local nature moving forward, the discussion about what is the right distribution, how do you push the available money through the system to get to that. So that's an ongoing thing that we'll be working on over the rest of this calendar year. So this is a historical comparison. I think this is both, you'll see highway highlighted in orange and then rail and public transportation below. And the story of this slide really is you can see the growth, and you will see in, but you see a slight downturn between the FY 14-19 budget and the 15-20 budget. You get two things, a decrease in revenue and also a planned reduction in the amount of bond sales. So again, the planned reduction in bond sales, it was planned. We'd assumed that the plan was going to go down, but the other is a reduced revenue coming in.
Point here is we're hoping to get those bonds reauthorized as we go out, and particularly is helpful to transit. But that's what we're hoping to do. Remember, this was the McDonald administration moving forward the Garvey bonds. We've issued them once. We had a limit. It was a sunset. We're hoping to get that reauthorized.
The next slide here breaks it down a little further into the various programs. Again, you can see how the six-year plan has grown, frankly, significantly since the 2011 plan, and this just breaks it down into where the money is being programmed. So next, I want to talk about, some priorities, deficient pavements, deficient bridges. Part of going into this updated six-year plan, being conscious of House Bill 2, increase in the revenue sharing program, we're now up to about $180 million. Jennifer Brule will be up in a little bit. She'll talk about that program. A reminder again about the federal program. And then supporting preliminary engineering to develop the project pipeline. And this is absolutely critical to us. We have to have, except for maintenance projects, which can be very quickly assembled and put on the streets, a paving project, that type of thing. Even a bridge rehab project takes time to develop the engineering, the environmental documents, and the like. So we want to make sure that we have a robust engineering program so that the projects are not waiting on the engineering, that the projects are really waiting on prioritization and they're waiting on funding so that they're ready to go when if it's a priority and it has money. We never want it to be waiting on the engineering. So that's something that the chief engineer and his staff have been working very diligently on. So I'm going to go through some highlights of the program. Now, these are projects. There's a combination of projects that are already underway, that are continuing to be funded. There are projects that are in design, that are being continuing to develop. So it's a mix of things. But I think it highlights throughout the state of Virginia the projects that we've got included here, and district by district, improvements in Bristol, Exit 14 being one of them, the Corridor Q projects and the Coalfields Expressway, especially projects where Coalfields and the Expressway overlap, the 58 corridor development improvements. A small piece of that actually is in the Bristol district. The bulk of the improvements, though, are in the Salem district. In the Culpeper District, 29 Route 666 interchange, that's the high school in the town of Culpeper, Rappahannock River Bridge improvements. Of course, down below are the improvements, the package of solutions for the Charlottesville area on an Albemarle on Route 29.
Mr. Patrick, if I may write
this. Yes,
there.
Sir.
Can you go back to the other? What we have done here is based on the recommendations. Have put in there the recommendations of the SHUCAT panel into the six-year plan on that. So when you vote tomorrow on the six-year plan, inherent in there will be those recommendations. I wanted to point that out. We had talked about a separate vote Based on the MPO's actions that happened much more quickly, the resolution that I brought up last month, they've already done. They've already said they're going to put that into their plan. So it is in here. I did not see the need to go for a separate vote. If the board would like to discuss those, we can go through them. But they are in here as the package. Now, Ms. Mathis is set up. We've gotten some comments, and we'll probably have some comments tomorrow. And I've had several meetings with individuals in the area. I will tell you that they're overwhelmingly, 7 or 8 to 1 people supporting the recommendations. The major people, the people who aren't supportive are supportive of all but the Rio interchange is what I'm hearing from the business community up there. And I've met with Mr. Crutchfield and others. What we'll be voting on tomorrow is simply allocating the monies. The projects still have to go through the process to be actually done. I would expect, and I have committed to, they would still go through the normal public outreach, and we go through everything that we normally do before we do the project. So we are, the vote tomorrow is allocating money. It's not to vote to start beginning construction of the project, but it's to take the package, what the governor said before we move these monies around, that we would see if we could come up with something. We've gotten support from both Albemarle and the City of Charlottesville and the MPO, which is the first time any of those three have all agreed on these recommendations. So that's why it's in here the way it is, just like 460 is in here, even though we don't have exactly what's going to happen on that in that regard. Those things are still in this plan when we get to it. I plan next month to go through again in very detail where we stand on these projects, 460 and others, so the board is up to speed as we go through on there. So I just want to let you know that's how we've handled the Route 29 and 460 projects in here. So they'll be, when you vote tomorrow, they are in this plan. Just wanted to point that out to the board in that regard. I think I've talked with most of you individually, but if I haven't, I wanted to make sure that was clear as to how we're going tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about the slide. It says totaling $230 million from the package of recommendations, and I thought the package was $203. Does this include?
This includes additional monies for fully funding the second train. So this has been enhanced over and above. Now that's, I don't mean to steal the thunder of the governor, but that includes the entire funding for the second train.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You noticed that, I couldn't let it just get through.
You couldn't ask
me. I apologize.
No, it does. And that's, we very believe that. And so we were able to work with the RPT and others to come up with the funding for the second train.
I'm moving now to the Fredericksburg District. Get a couple of highlights. Continued funding towards improvements on I-95 across the Rappahannock River, Falmouth Intersection, which is under construction. Another bridge project I think it's important to highlight, Chatham Bridge, which is State Route 3 business in Fredericksburg across the Rappahannock, is a structure in need of some significant repairs. Dropping down into Hampton Roads District, the I-64 capacity improvements on the peninsula. And we are currently, I believe, going out for a solicitation on that, and we'll be going through the contracting process through the balance of this year on moving that project forward. Route 58 interchange, that's in Cortland, Southampton County. The Military Highway, this is a project that's been an on-again, off-again project for a number of years. It's called a continuous flow intersection in a very heavily traveled part of Norfolk. Near the airport. Also, to complete the funding of the Turnpike Road in Portsmouth, this again is a project that's been delayed, funded, unfunded, and so again this completes the funding to move that project forward. Lynchburg District, Oddfellows Road, and that's really a Oddfellows Road project, which is interchange and roadway, as well as a separate facility called Greenview Drive. continued construction on the bridge over the James River on 501. Also, a couple small projects, completing a sidewalk project in Charlotte Courthouse, and also a streetscaping project in Dillwyn. And those two were projects that came up during the six-year plan process, as well as the project below, advancing the funding of this Route 40 bridge. Again, we heard from the board member and citizens. This particular bridge was on the program to be rehabilitated and replaced. We were able to make some adjustments so that could happen sooner. In Northern Virginia, moving forward on the 66, the Tier 2, which is the second part of the environmental document. This is 66 outside of the Beltway, from the Beltway to Haymarket, with the potential to develop the P3 project. And we're working very closely with Fairfax County and Prince William County on that project, and we'll have an update in the July meeting, I believe, on the status of that project. The 495 shoulder improvements, I'll call it the tail of the hot lanes heading towards the American Legion Bridge. Bridge deck replacement, Route 7 over the Dulles Toll Road, and then the 6628 interchange, just another highly congested area in Northern Virginia. In Richmond, the Lewiston Road bridge replacement, and this is actually interchange improvement project there at Bass Pro Shop, just north of Richmond. A lot of pavement rehabilitation on 85 and 295. That pavement is in some significant distress, and that's part of the improvement program we're working on. Also noted here is the Capitol Trail, which continues. That trail runs from downtown Richmond to Williamsburg, and we're continuing to move that project along. And then finally, Nottoway County, acceleration lane in Nottoway, that also came up during the public hearings. In the Salem District, improvements to 220, and these are safety improvements along the 220 corridor. Again, another project. We heard a lot of input during the six-year plan process. The exit 150, that's Troutville, that's a significant amount of both truck and car traffic at the 81 interchange. 81 northbound bridge, that is the bridge, the New River in Radford, or just outside of Radford. Completing the funding of the Southgate interchange on 460 at Virginia Tech. The Falling Branch Park and Ride lot, which may have been the most popular discussion of all the hearings, being able to fund moving this Falling Branch Park and Ride lot away from the adjacent elementary school to a more suitable location. On that particular one, I spoke with the resident engineer last week, and he believes that they'll be able to put together an interim lot before the end of this calendar year. So that's been the focus of trying to get that the bus traffic moved away from there this year. Another project that recently received some press out in Salem is the improvements on 81 in northern Botetourt County. This stretch of interstate near I don't know whether they call it Buckhannon or Buchanan there, but we'll go with Buckhannon. An S curve on 81 that's caused some real problems over the years, and putting some money towards engineering a solution there. And then the 58 corridor improvement.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Can I ask a question on that? That was just noticed this was added, and that great thing. I think Sunday there was a big fire wreck that was Buckhannon that rerouted traffic. I assume that what was being talked about earlier, the fact that this is being added now, the PE, prior to prioritization.
I was going to mention there are 15 projects clearly safety related, which are not prioritized.
Okay.
These are clearly safety projects that we identified 15 during these public hearings that we were able to find. We felt it was easier to fund them or get them going because they were clearly safety related. So we just didn't go through the motions of going to the hearings. But Mr. Propane, you're bringing that up. I was going to mention it, that these are would not be part of either safety-related projects.
Thank you.
Moving on to the Stanton District, exit 310, that's up in Frederick County, Route 11 at Cedar Creek, and then pavement rehabilitation projects on 81 in the Stanton district are just a couple of the highlights. The last one, ADA improvements, working with Federal Highway Administration, the Justice Department. This is an ongoing effort to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act in terms of, it's largely handicapped grants as we rehabilitate roads and repave roads and really taking an active step in not any new project we build today would incorporate ADA features, but we have a lot of existing roadway that does not, and this is assisting us in moving towards improving accessibility. And again, it's largely in the area of accessible ramps for our pedestrians. And with that, I'm going to hand it back to Jennifer, and she's going to talk about rail and public transportation.
So first, I'd like to just go over a few of the overarching priorities that were used as we put together our recommendations for the six-year plan. The first one refers to the methodology that Steve Pittard discussed when he was presenting the budget. And this is the new allocation methodology for both capital and operating assistance. This came out of a group called the Transit Service Delivery Advisory Committee, or TSDAC. Mr. Cole over here is a member of that, and we thank him very much for his very active involvement as well. That did recommend a performance metric-based way of allocating our operating funds, which is the basis for this year's allocation as well. And similarly, on the capital side, it uses a number of tiers that are used to define the state match that's used for different types of capital projects as well. Another priority is maximizing the use of federal funds. This is especially important in our rural areas where we have rural providers that are highly dependent on certain categories of federal funds for operations and capital. We have a number of projects that are really designed to make some very strategic investments in some high priority fixed guideway transit projects as well as some passenger and freight projects across the state, and I'll highlight some of those in just a couple slides. We've got funding for continuing to expand our passenger rail service to Roanoke and for in the future to Norfolk as well. We have some additional funding that was included in the six-year plan to help support some of the what's called small urban systems that were affected by changes in the 2010 census that impacted how much federal funding that they received. So in some cases, we were able to allocate some additional state funding that helped mitigate the impacts of those changes as well. And then finally, this last bullet refers to multi-year programming. And on the transit side, our capital needs are really programmed on an annual basis, whereas the six-year plan on the rail side truly is a six-year allocation of funds. We are in the process, though, of moving to a multi-year programming on the transit capital side. So some of the allocations that are in here now really lay the groundwork for that, particularly for some of the large capital projects. A few of the transit capital projects or capital operating needs that I would like to highlight here, one of these is funding for the light rail extension to Virginia Beach, which I know that many of you have already heard about. But we have entered into, I guess, a tentative, we've agreed on some terms at least for potentially funding the first phase of light rail extension of the tide out to Virginia Beach. It's not a grant agreement in this place or a firm commitment. That project is still going through the environmental process, and they are in the process of selecting a locally preferred alternative. Once that occurs, we'll start moving forward with some steps to firm up the commitment there. That's very similar for the next project as well, which is the Arlington and Fairfax counties are developing a streetcar project which runs along Columbia Pike, and this is a project that we have also included in a placeholder for some fixed guideway transit funding. That project is still also in the planning phases. We are working with Fairfax County and Arlington County to understand their funding request and potentially in the future be able to enter into an agreement for that as well.
Mr. Chair. Hi, Mr. Brzezinski.
Jen, on that particular one, Arlington, the streetcar, you know, Northern Virginia has been inundated with who's for it and the people supportive, including the city and the county governments. And now there's arisen objections from some members in Arlington on the particular streetcar situation, but are we ever, before funds are requested of CTV, will there be a third party, independent party, who can tell us the difference between, you know, what is proposed with streetcar versus a bus rapid transit system? Because, you know, there's all kinds of publicity on both sides, and I'd be sitting here saying, okay, what's the reality of this before we give away funds?
I'll be very clear on this one aspect of this. The alternative that is selected is a local decision. And and that is the policy that we at DRPT and VDOT as well follow for locally funded projects. So in this case, I understand that as with many projects across the state, there's differences in opinion about what projects should be, what an alternative should be. However, at the end of the day, it's a local decision. And so when they come to us with a funding request, we evaluate it based on the eligibility for the program, the merit of the project in terms of statewide goals and objectives, funding availability, those types of things.
But not the specific of what vehicle.
Should it be bus or should it be streetcar? That's really their decision.
This is a placeholder. We have not any grant agreement. Same with Virginia Beach. It is the same technology as Virginia Beach, though. In other words, it's a very similar car. They call it a street. It's light rail is what it is. But sorry, I didn't mean to interject there. But both of these will require granting, and you will have to, vote on approving the grant requests.
Yeah.
These are basically placeholders, identified projects actually the projects are good, and we'll see after they finish all the environmental work where it shakes out of.
The next project I wanted to highlight is a bus rapid transit project here in Richmond along Broad Street, and we've been working with the city and also with GRTC on this project, and it's also in the planning phases as well. The city has submitted a TIGER application, which is a federally funded program, and we're optimistic and hopeful at least that we'll be able to receive some construction funds from that, and they should know about that later in the summer. Across the plan, we have funded 34 expansion vehicles, and that includes VRE rail cars as well, in addition to 175 vehicles across the state, and those are all replacement for state of good repair needs. We have funding in the plan for a maintenance and administration facility in Lynchburg, which is underway right now, and also a multi-year funding commitment to provide track lease payments for Virginia Railway Express. This is something that the state has traditionally funded on an annual basis, but this is the first time that we'll be entering into a multi-year agreement to provide VRE with the stability and predictability that they need in order to fund those ongoing commitments.
Mr. Chairman, can I just note that I think that's a very good move because I've been involved up there in Northern Virginia, so I commend you for putting that in. I think that's a big step forward. So.
Yeah, very, very important. Again, it's that stability and long-term predictability that is really critical for that system.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr.
Jen, is that just the current system, or is there any dollars in there for the possible deal with Norfolk Southern to get out to Gainesville, which I guess has been a stumbling block for quite a few years?
Right now, there are. We don't have specific funding in the plan for that project. I know that they're looking at NBTA funds as well as other sources of funds for that as well. That could be in the program in the future should the CTB want to do that. We do have some funds, and I'll get to this in the rail slides, that are for Norfolk Southern. There are improvements along the Norfolk Southern line in that vicinity that could actually free up some capacity that could help that project down the road. But at this point, we don't have specific project funds for that project, the Gainesville Haymarket extension, in here.
Thank you.
I was asked to summarize also just the WMATA funding. We provide funding to WMATA in several different buckets. The total is about $200 million this year. That includes matching funds to the local jurisdictions for operating, for capital, sort of the base capital program for PREA. And what that refers to is a match to a federal funds that have been committed for state of good repair needs. And The Commonwealth provides $50 million a year, along with D.C. and Maryland, who also put in $50 million a year each. And then the last one is for the first year, it's a down payment on what WMATA is referring to as their Momentum Program, which is their reinvestment and expansion program. The Commonwealth has contributed a total of $25 million, along with $25 million from Maryland and D.C. each. Of that, we are funding $9 million of that, and the localities are putting in $16 million for that. In the rail program, as we've referred to before, we did include funding for the expansion to Roanoke. We've also got the ongoing support for our existing regional trains. There's six of them across the state right now. Additional funding for capital improvements to support the two additional trains to Norfolk in the future. Track improvements between Alexandria and Lynchburg, and this does refer to Mr. Gazinski's question before regarding some of the improvements in that area for that could benefit the Gainesville Haymarket extension for VRE. And then we are also using our Rail Enhancement Fund to fund platform improvements for VRE, which actually frees up capacity on the CSX line that enables VRE to put in the Potomac Shores Station in Prince William County as well. Just very quickly, a few more of the projects in our rail program. We've got additional funding for the draft EIS for high-speed rail between Richmond and the Potomac area, which we're working on right now, and that's also being funded by the Federal Railroad Administration as well. Projects in the vicinity of the Port Authority to provide additional access to the port. Ongoing funding for Norfolk Southern improvements in the Crescent Corridor, which is along the I-81 corridor. Funding for the Elliston intermodal facilities in the out years, and then also funding for a bridge clearance project here in along Broad Street, just down the street, down the hill from here, which also provides freight benefits, but also does provide some additional benefits to the Broad Street BRT project as well.
Mr. Rose?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Mitchell, could you give a little more detail on the Elliston intermodal facility project? It seems to be one that has gone by the wayside with Norfolk Southern, so I'm curious, the inclusion of it in the plan, I'm curious.
We have continued to have funding for it in the out years of the program. At this point, there's no firm plans from Norfolk Southern to implement that, but we're continuing to work with them on it. I think at some point, I don't know if there will be a possibility that in the future that will be revisited, but it is, you know, it's been a priority on an economic development standpoint to have that in the program, and we're continuing to work with Norfolk Southern on it. But it's in the out years right now.
Just to make a point on that point, we are evaluating our relationships with both CSX and Norfolk Southern, and looking at our global relationships with both as it relates to our ports, as it relates to our funding going out. We didn't want to make any changes until we have, you know, sat down and said here's where the state would like to go, working with them. So part of it is why it's in there. We clearly get that this has been in there a while. They're not pushing on it at all. But until we have sat down and decided how that's all going to play out, and there's some significant issues to deal with them on the ports in that regard, we're just, try to leaving things as they are as we work through these issues as they come up.
I wondered if there might be, and that's good to hear, and you know, I can see where you're going with that. You know, I wondered if this was a facility that may not be necessarily totally reliant on Norfolk Southern, but rather an inland port type facility instead. Thank you.
Right. So, but that's where it is. We would expect by next year to have a clearer vision as to how these what they are. The dollars may be there, but on something different.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And just very quickly, I'd like to highlight a few of the new projects that are in the final program that were not necessarily in the draft program. Some of these are the result of public comments that we heard. Some of these are the results of just additional discussions with the grantees between the time that we put together the draft and the final. One of them is funding for an Arlington transit maintenance facility. We also have included some funds that will be going to NVTC for what they're calling the new electronic payment program implementation, but it's a fair integration system study, very important for the transit providers up in Northern Virginia. We've included funding in out years for the proposed Newport News multimodal station. It's a project that they've been working on, and we've been discussing future funding commitments with them as well. This would be for, we usually typically don't fund stations necessarily. This would be for track work and a maintenance facility that would help separate passenger rail from CSX traffic in that corridor. Additional funds for transit operations that are going to be part of the mitigation plan or part of the transit operations plan with the implementation of the I-95 hot lanes. As Commissioner Kilpatrick referred to before, that we've included some transit funding for the park and ride in the Salem District, which we received a lot of public comments about, and this is also because it includes an intercity bus facility at the park and ride, which had generated a bit of concern, and we have the ability to use some funds that intercity bus is eligible for to help relocate that facility too. And then based on some additional work that we've done with WMATA and NVTC, there was a change to the allocation of funding between the transit operators across the state because of the way we were counting ridership with WMATA. We also added funding that was originally expected to be used for operations of the Silver Line last year that did not open last year, so we've moved that funding into FY15, and that had the effect of essentially adding some funding statewide that all the impacted all of the transit operators across the state. The delta was relatively small, but it was a change between the draft and final.
Do any or all of these, are they subject to HB2 priority also?
These particular projects are not. HB2 excludes transit capital funds from the categories of funds and the rail funds as well that are subject to prioritization. However, to the extent that transit projects would like to compete for federal funds or for highway funds, those projects could be included in prioritization.
Mr. Chairman, if the Marketplace Fairness Act doesn't pass, and it's quite substantial when it comes to rail, I assume are all of these projects based on the fact that we believe it will pass, or do you keep separate, this is based on it not passing?
We have not included that in this plan because we recognize, well, we want to be conservative, but also we recognize that it may not happen. Thank you for pointing out it is a significant impact. As Steve pointed out earlier, it really would impact the transit program significantly. So it's something we'll continue to evaluate. But
On that topic, couple things that Mr. Dykman pointed out. Transit, unlike highway, is usually a continuing because of many of the operation side, like VRE, lease track payments. So allocating that once a year, they really can't run their operations on that. It's the same thing with talking about your comment about if we get the monies. Our real issue is if we aren't able to reauthorize these bonds, that's going to curtail significantly what we can do in transit. The Marketplace Equity Act would be great, but that is a threat to the extent we're looking past what 2020, I guess it is.
It was really 2019.
2019, yes, about our continuing. So that is more a threat to us. We'll get to the Federal Highway Fund, but which takes the transit too. But, that is really more impactful to transit in that. Because most of the time, and this back to your comments, Ms. Brzezinski, too, in transit, our role, we're a policy board, and not that we don't think, but if it's compliant and legal, the rules that she works under are, they got to be considered. In other words, the program, that's what the monies are there for. If we don't like the programs, we can ask the legislator to change them, but that's really not our role in that regard. So not suggesting that we just blindly follow because we don't, but I'm saying it's more unlike highway, it's a little bit different.
And if I could just add to that, one of the important things to remember about transit capital needs as well is that these are not necessarily the big projects we're talking about, although those would certainly be impacted by that huge drop in capital funding. It's really a statewide impact, especially when you look at some of the smaller cities and rural areas across the state. They have capital needs that they need to continue replacing vans and buses and purchasing spare parts for those things. And the impact of that is that it could drop the match for a bus, for example, from, 68% state funding down to about 34% state funding. What that means is that the locality has to pick up the remainder of that. So it's a huge impact on the state and local governments that are funding transit. So it's not necessarily these big projects that you think you could just push them out a couple of years and flatten out the curve and things like that. It would really have a huge impact across the state on state and local governments. So that's something we're working very hard to make sure people realize that.
Yeah, and just to piggyback a little bit on that, I'm particularly glad to see the reference of a number of these transit programs, because one of the things that I think we need to focus on is laying the groundwork to let people know that transit does have great potential around the state that perhaps we haven't focused in on. And to the extent we get more discussion of it, even though we may not get all these projects initially, by getting people to at least think about those and options and buses, not only light rail. I was glad to see, for example, Virginia Beach light rail, because I had a chance to actually go down there and see what they were contemplating, what they were thinking about. And so I'm pleased to see so many of these things there, and hopefully people will start to factor that in now when they think about multimodal transportation.
Okay, thanks. I think that's it for our presentation. I don't know if there's any other questions for me or Commissioner Kilpatrick.
Yes, Chairman, you mentioned the reauthorization of the bonds a couple times. Can you spend a little time on that?
Sure, we'll be happy to give a presentation. These are bonds that were originally, they come about the Kane administration, may have been before, I think it was the Kane administration, where it was anticipated that over a 10-year period, the Commonwealth would be able to issue bonds to support transit, or support transportation. During the McDonald years, they were in the legislature to let those bonds be moved forward. So many were issued, therefore the funding, now transit did keep some of this, but therefore it precluded, you can only use the money once, you pull it forward, it's on projects, many of them P3 projects, quite frankly, and therefore now we don't have that revenue source, and so we're seeing we got money here and doing this. Now, they are and they are included in our computation of our AAA credit rating, and so we're working with Secretary Brown. And this year, no way we could have got them in, and based on what's going on with the budget, there's no way we could have got them in. But we hope to be looking at that for next year, making sure we can get those reauthorized. Again, not to go over the original amount, $3.1 billion, but back up to that amount. As we pay them down, that did not appear to hurt our AAA credit rating. So hopefully that can get done. But we'll get a better presentation, we'll have it done, but that's sort of the issue in a nutshell in that board. Any other questions for the Chiefs while they're up here? All right, well, thank you very much. Okay, September, this year? Yes. Oh, next year. So we're gonna, as we go around the state, one of the things we're going to try to, in September of next year, we'll be back in Northern Virginia. We'll try to get transit, particularly in Northern Virginia and areas in Hampton, to put those projects on our list to see, because, mm-hmm. I mean, that's one thing I think we could emphasize a little more, I think, as a board, is how we utilize transit in these dollars here.
Yeah, and on behalf of my Northern Virginia colleagues, we offer you an opportunity to ride on the Silver Line, which hopefully will be starting very soon.
Yeah, I was told a tentative date today, but it's changed so many times. I'm not going to say anything until we actually.
We'll just say it's coming.
It's coming. That's right. We're still coming in that regard. So. Okay, Mr. Brule.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. It's a pretty big month for local programs and our relationships with local governments, and so I want to take a few minutes and give you a briefing on some of those special funding programs that you'll see on tomorrow's action agenda. You've already heard the revenue sharing program mentioned a few times. We'll go into a little bit of background on the revenue sharing program, talk about transportation alternatives, the maintenance payments that we make to local government. And also, I have listed on the slide, but not really in the presentation. Last month, I made a presentation to you on two new programs, one for funding paving on primary extensions maintained by local government, and the other one for high-volume unpaved roads. Both of those will also be on your action agenda tomorrow, as they were presented last month. So starting out with the revenue sharing program, this is a program that's established by code, and it's basically a dollar-for-dollar 50-50 match, a dollar of local government money matched with a dollar of state money to deliver transportation projects. By code, the board can allocate up to $200 million per year to the revenue sharing program in state matching funds, and localities can request up to $10 million in applications per year. Of that $10 million, $5 million can be set aside for maintenance projects. The code also is pretty specific in how those projects are prioritized for funding. The first priority is given to construction projects that will be accelerated, that are either in the six-year program or a locality's capital improvement program. The next priority is given to funding paving projects and bridge rehabilitation projects where the infrastructure is below our performance target, and you heard Chief Engineer Moore talk about those performance targets a little earlier today. We go through a formal application process for revenue sharing, and it actually starts in the summer. We ask localities to put together their applications with a deadline of November 1st. That application process starts so early so that we have the opportunity to get those applications in, share those budget numbers with you shortly after the first of the year so that we can try to budget funds to meet the required or the requested funding that's available. In terms of fiscal year 15, which you'll see for action tomorrow, we had requests from 79 localities. 8 of those localities requested the maximum of $10 million match. Our total requests are just over $180 million, with the majority of those requests being for advancing construction projects. Next slide gives you a breakdown of those requests by district and by amount. You'll see that localities around the state participate in the program. It's really distributed well across the state. And I want to point out, and I did this when we made a similar presentation in January, the Lynchburg District. That's a district where we haven't seen a lot of participation over the last few years. And thanks to the hard work of our folks out in the district, working with their local partners, we've seen increased participation in the Lynchburg District this year.
Thank you. And you were, you know, very right. And I think nearly all the projects that were proposed actually made it into the plan. But there are some districts that can't afford the match or aren't able to revenue share, which is part of the reason I think some districts are not able to participate fully. And how do we deal with those?
The way that the code is structured, it is a dollar-for-dollar match. We have seen some localities that through public-private partnerships have made some, you know, some interesting agreements to move projects forward where they've worked with developers to use proffer funds for their local share for a roadway project, or we've actually seen public-private projects that have, you know, we had a project where a developer was doing a lot of the earthwork for the project that helped offset the local match. So we've seen some unique approaches to that, but yes, it is a challenge for those localities that have that struggle with the economics.
And Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking, you know, that would be something really great for some of us, I think, to know about is how do you think creatively to help these localities,
right,
you know, access these funds? And
In the regions that have the regional monies, they're able to put them on, I think, in that. Then, as Jennifer's mentioned, where we've encouraged others to team up with the private or others that are willing to come up with the match. So we'll try to work, you know, hard with them, but unfortunately the code is, or the law is, it's a 50% match. And that's it. But it is most popular program. It continues to grow. And we tend to, I think we're over allocated almost every year. I mean, we have more money.
You're correct.
The program has grown each year. We've increased the allocation as we've gotten more applications. This year we're at 180 million with a cap led by code of 200 million. So today we're capped under the code at 200 million.
We do ask localities to give us some planning numbers out into the future. It's hard for them to do that because of budget uncertainties. But looking at the percentage of localities that have responded to that request for planning data and kind of what that looks like when you extrapolate it out, we think next year or the year after we'll be over 200.
Is it code or is it CTB subsidy?
Code limits it to 200 million.
So we'd have to ask.
We would have to go back to the General Assembly
to ask for
request additional offers.
So that may be something we need to look at.
Okay. In terms of program value, you think a dollar of local money and a dollar of state money, you're doubling your dollars. Really, the revenue sharing program is all about leveraging. When you look at localities that have invested in revenue sharing over the years for a priority project, or they're matching it up with other funds that have been identified on a project, private money, other local funds, the value of the revenue sharing program is much greater than $360 million. When you look at all of the funding that's leveraged on this project, the $180 million in revenue sharing that the state's allocating this year actually gets us almost $880 million worth of projects when you look at everything put together. So it does have a significant impact on projects that otherwise wouldn't be funded or wouldn't be moving forward. Again, another representation of how geographically diverse the applicant localities are. We are seeing applications from all around the state, including one from the city of Bristol for $10 million. That's their second year in a row requesting $10 million to support a major economic development project in their area. So our recommendation and what you will see for action tomorrow is allocation of a little over $180 million in revenue sharing funds. Most of that comes from budget that has been set aside for fiscal year 2015. We also go through a pretty aggressive process of deallocating funds on projects that don't move forward. We'll bring you that list of projects in January. Typically in January each year, we did deallocate $4.7 million off of basically old completed revenue sharing projects, but some that just had not moved forward back in January to help offset this year's application. So we're able to fund all the requests, and there's no proration required this year. In terms of next steps for the revenue sharing program, after the board considers approving the 2015 allocations tomorrow, we will communicate those to the localities, and those funds will become available on July 1st. We also have a little nuance in the revenue sharing code. It's the only special funding program where the board is required to approve the guidelines and any changes to the program guidelines. So we have a few changes that we need to make to the guidelines before we can go out with the next solicitation. We'll bring that to you for action next month. Very, very minor in terms of clarifying some eligibility for drainage projects and also cleaning up some of our transfer and deallocation language. We'll do
Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Rule, do we, on a outreach to the General Assembly, can we notify those delegates and state senators in whose districts receives the revenue sharing so they know about it as well? If we ever wanted to go back and say it's such a great program, it should be increased, I think they should be informed. And it helps us, and I think kind of helps them and the locality to make sure people know we're very transparent on the revenue sharing.
Mr. Chairman?
Did you get one?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's looks like to me we're going to need to go back and ask them to increase it because we can leverage our money's 50%. I don't think that's something we'd like to do. So, absolutely.
We'll open the solicitation for fiscal year 16 revenue sharing funds in early August. We're actually going to kick it off in a webinar next week, but we will solicit applications beginning in early August with an October 31st deadline and come to you in January with an update on where we are in terms of applications and also any money for deallocation that we can use towards the fiscal year 16 program. Switching gears a little bit, transportation alternatives. The commissioner mentioned this in his presentation, and it's small in dollar value, but big in impact for local governments. Transportation alternatives is a federal program. It changed significantly with the passage of MAP 21 a couple of years ago and combined a number of small federal programs under one transportation alternatives umbrella. So it's what's known, most of what was covered under the old transportation enhancement program is included, along with safe routes to school and recreational access projects. There's 10 categories of eligibility. I'll show you those in a second on another slide. But we have a process that's set out by CTB policy. We use that process for the fiscal year 15 allocations. And as a result of the changes in MAP 21, we now work with 16 metropolitan six metropolitan planning organizations around the state that make their own selections, and those are the areas that are over 200,000 population. The district board members make selections in their areas. That's $1 million per board member, or $9 million in funding. And the remaining funding is set aside, worked on as a group by the CTB at-large members and the secretary, focused on...
Oh, no.
Mr. Wade.
Well, the at-large members and you...
Well, we've had this argument before, haven't we?
I didn't want to start one, but I saw this yesterday, and I'm like...
We're sort of secondary citizens in this. The district members get to allocate, and then we get the scraps left over. But I will tell you, as a CTB member, you will get more calls on this program than anything else, because there's a lot of grants, and actually I kind of can do a lot of good. But Mr. Williams, I have no problem looking at this, but as it stands now, that's the way it's done. We had a former at-large member.
I recommend the senator read the minutes
from the last 4 years.
I think every time I've stood in front of the podium and talked about this program, I've had that question, and it was a change several years ago. We had a number of projects that had languished for a long time, but they had gotten a little bit of money here and there. The board policy shifted, let's say, about 4 or 5 years ago, to put focus on fully funding projects so those projects could get out of the pipeline and to completion, and the at-large members work very well with staff and the district members to fully fund projects and get those projects funded to construction and off the books. And so they work very hard with us trying to go back and fill those gaps and take care of those needs.
The theory is with the at-large members is just trying to focus dollars that can be meaningful on projects that are statewide. In other words, that we, like a couple years ago, what was the anniversary of the, well, was it the state, the James, no, what?
No, we had the
war, Civil War.
The Civil War.
Civil War, Civil War. So there were a lot of things in that regard. So that's really what the theory behind it, so we could have some lump sum we could set down and say these are statewide things that we ought to support, not just in each district. That's the theory behind it. Mr. Rose.
Thank you. I agree completely with Mr. Williams on this, and actually had a conversation this morning about this, and that does make sense in many ways. The flip side is that the at-large working with various district folks who you may be working on a project that are sort of on the line of two districts where you can supplement money needed to make that impact you're talking about.
Yeah, and you can still do that. I mean, because it doesn't have to go all the way to that. But here, the other thing to this, too, and it really, even though you are an at-large member from a district, you're really an at-large member, even though you're supposed to, and Jim and I were talking about this morning, you're just as much responsible for the districts you don't live in as you are. And that's another reason for having it this way, is to focus that group, really. I know it's hard not to because you live in a particular area, but it's really to get you thinking statewide. And that's part of it. And that. So, but we do, you do, what I would do with the at-large that were in the district that I was in, is say, look, I'm going to put it on these projects. I can't get to these. I would work with them and say, what do you want me to do? We'd work together. So I would, you would still certainly do that. And that, so.
All right. So for the balance of the selection policy, back to that point of we try to get projects to have a meaningful allocation so they can move forward. Projects that are selected have to receive no less than 50% of the funds that they've requested. If the project's under $200,000, the policy states that the request will be fully funded in order to be selected. So that is all focused on getting those projects funded in through the pipeline. One change that we made to the selection policy last year was that projects selected must be under construction within 4 years of that first allocation availability, again, with a focus on getting projects done so that we can make that impact on those communities. Eligible categories, I won't go into detail on this, but there are 10 categories by federal law. We see the bulk of our applications and the bulk of the selected projects really fall into bicycle and pedestrian improvements, and we're seeing more. We had a couple of projects this year that were focused on ADA compliance for transit connections. So really focused on bicycle, pedestrian, and moving people. In terms of applications, we also do a fairly early application cycle with the Transportation Alternatives Program. We received applications November 1st of last year. We had 75 of them requesting over $27 million in funding. We had about 18.8 to allocate. So obviously not everybody received what they requested, but that those applications are scored based on a technical score, and projects that are existing also receive a readiness score so that you can see as you go through that process, you know, the value of a project to the community and also how ready it is to move forward. I always like to touch a little bit on the program itself. The program's been around for over 20 years. We've got over 1,000 individual projects that have been selected. Almost 600 of those projects now have been completed. We have over 300 that are active in some stage of development or under construction. But the big story here is that 64% of the funds have been expended. If you go back to before that CTV policy changed, we had one of the lowest reimbursement rates in the country, and we had a lot of little projects that were languishing with a little bit of money. And so the focus has been on getting projects done and through the pipeline, and you've seen our expenditure rate go up accordingly with that change. In terms of next steps with the Transportation Alternatives Program, pending your approval tomorrow, we will communicate those selections to localities, and then we immediately turn around and start on applicant workshops for fiscal year 2016. We're scheduling those around the state for July and August to go out and work with those project sponsors, some of which aren't your normal local government partners. We work with a lot of interesting partners in this program to get them ready for a November 1st application deadline. We'll come back to you in February with an update on the Transportation Alternatives Program and the slate of projects that we've received for potential selection in fiscal year 16. Last slide, but the biggest dollar value, I think, so far is to talk a little bit about local maintenance payments. We make payments on a quarterly basis to the localities that maintain their own infrastructure. You'll see that in two action items tomorrow. The first are our urban cities and towns. That's 84 cities and towns that maintain their own infrastructure. The budget for that program is almost $350 million, and we pay those localities on the basis of basically functional classification. Is it a arterial road or is it a collector and local road? And then we have a different per lane mile rate for each of those. It's a little over $19,000 per lane mile for those arterial routes and a little over $11,000 per lane mile for collectors and locals. You can see the lane mileage up on the screen. We also make payments to the two counties that never became part of the secondary system back in 1932. That's Arlington and Henrico. The budget for those two counties together is about $62 million. Henrico receives just shy of $18,000 per lane mile, and Henrico receives just shy of $13,000 per lane mile.
Mr. Chairman,
wasn't there some legislation this year equalizing? We were talking about that yesterday, Ron.
It might have been submitted, but it wasn't.
Yeah, it's always, didn't we have a task force two years ago?
And
we wrestled with that, right?
Just to bear with me for a second. Roger, during our conversation yesterday, didn't Mr. Hawthorne discuss an equalization between Henrico and Arlington that he was going to have to accommodate in the lane mile reimbursement?
Regarding some proposed legislation?
That's right. They asked for a proposed legislation that will bubble all the way through the process. Mr. Chairman,
actually, House Bill 2313 established a new base rate for Henrico last year that basically increased Henrico and held Arlington steady. And so now those two new base rates grow at the same rate as everybody else, which was 3.5% this year.
but they're still, what is the statewide rate that we reimburse?
The rates are...
No, in other words, well, we give Arlington 17, 8, right. We give Henry, does everybody else get?
The rest are budgeted as part of VDOT secondary system.
Yeah, but I mean, have you ever computed the lane mile?
The average per lane mile has been about $5,000 a lane mile. Of course, secondary.
Yeah, it's about, what, about five?
Five.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is substantially more than the rest of the state, and Arlington, you can get even more. So we've asked to be looked at this year for some time, but it is not, it is what it is. It is per code.
But there was a report done 2 years ago by a task force. Senator, you may want to take a look at if you're interested.
The last small piece of that is that there was a code change a couple of years ago. The state put basically a statewide standard for overweight permits, and we transfer a little bit of the revenue based on the proportional lane mileage back to the localities for the permit fees that are collected by DMV. So that's DMV money that comes through the department and goes straight back to the localities. A little over $410 million. And that is it. Lots on the action agenda tomorrow, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, what you've seen is, and you've got one more with Kevin to go for a specific grant, but what we've set it up is Mr. Lawson started with the overall and then bringing it down to the various component parts. That's what the presentation was today. And those will be the action items in the order in which you will vote on them tomorrow. Any questions for Mr. Brewer?
Yes,
Mr.
Tom. I have a question. I've seen one of the attachments that you showed changes in the lane mile. Is he changing
Mr. Chairman, there was an adjustment, a correction in their lane mileage. They had submitted lane mileage last year that didn't get processed. They submitted it in time, but it didn't get processed. So it's an adjustment for them from last year, and then those miles carry forward. So it does look a little unusual.
Any other questions? Mr. Rosen.
Did you have a question? No, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you were talking about the payments to localities, in particular cities, towns, Arlington, and RICO, is there a separate budget for bridge maintenance, repair, replacement, or that just gets factored in as a lane mile, regardless of whether, if it's a primary road, for instance, it's just factored in the normal?
And there's a fundamental difference between Henrico and Arlington and cities and towns to maintain their system. In Henrico and Arlington, they maintain their secondary system. VDOT continues to maintain the primary and the interstate system in those jurisdictions. In cities and towns, we continue to maintain the interstate system, we being VDOT, but both the primary and the secondary system, with some very, very rare exceptions, are maintained by the cities and towns. So that's a difference in terms of that calculation. But there's not a separate fund for maintenance of bridge structures for those cities and towns or for those counties.
Is the lane mile payment raise, does that factor in bridges within the number of bridges that are found within the 84?
The surface of the bridge is in the mile count.
But in terms of how much is allocated, I guess the best way to describe this is over a long history of the code as it's been written and how much flows based on the. This is based in code. We don't develop a formula and they get their share and it's not set up that way. It's actually articulated specifically in code.
Base rates for the urban localities were actually established in 1986 and have been adjusted since then.
I have no idea. I'm asked to see how their calculation. I have no idea how they came up with those numbers.
In the 80s.
In the 80s.
At this point, neither do the
other. I will not.
When they first came up with
it. Is it something we should, as a board, try to engage in?
Well, we have put up in our part of our legislative package that this ought to be looked at, but. So far, it is what it is.
Thank you, Mr.
Many of our, for the new members, many of our existing laws are from the 30s. I mean, from the birth, when the original was taken over from the states, I mean, from the counties and towns to the statewide allocation in that. In fact, the reason we looked at those, because the members that have been on the board a few years will say we were looking at devolution, giving them back. So that's when we got into all of that. And it's pretty obvious that it was always assumed that there would be always enough revenue raised to take care of all the roads. That was the theory if you look behind some of the law. I mean, it doesn't really matter because we're always going to raise enough revenue to take care of it. That didn't happen, and that's sort of some of the disconnect that we've been dealing with in that sense.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes, Mr. Cole.
If we can go back to the Transportation Alternatives Program, if, from what I've read, it seems to be one of those items that's being targeted as that it doesn't really fit into federal priorities from a transportation standpoint. Given that that possibility, has Virginia ever looked at doing something legislatively that Virginia would continue to fund this in some manner? Or does this program go away if in fact it's not a part of the highway reauthorization program?
I don't know if we've ever looked at anything.
Mr. Chairman, there was some budget language last year, might have been 2 years ago, to set aside some money for a state enhancement program, but it was earmarked for a specific project. Mm-hmm. And that was looking kind of at the future of it. The change from Safety Lou to MAP 21 in the federal legislation, we saw a significant decrease in the amount of money that went to what is now called transportation alternatives. I think what keeps it going is at the federal level, the advocacy groups that benefit from these funds are very, very active in working, you know, working the halls of Congress to make sure folks know what benefit this provides to, you know, particularly smaller localities around the country.
Did it come up in your testimony in front of the Senate Finance?
No, it didn't. We never got that. I mean, they were much bigger issues, whether they should fund it at all, the trust fund at all. Was a guy from the Cato Institute that basically said, let it go bankrupt, let the states deal with it. So it was more of that. It never got into really specifics of the programs.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kroll, thank you
very much.
Mr. Page, how are you today?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I'm the caboose at the end of the train, but it's a good one. We're on the Eastern Shore talking about a nice economic development project for a very fiscally distressed community. Today before you, Director Mitchell has asked me to bring forward the Coastline Chemical Company Rail Industrial Access sidetrack application. Those of you who may know the Eastern Shore of Virginia, very high in agricultural and very low in manufacturing processes. But we also have this whole space adventure over on Wallops Island, which actually, if you look on the map there at Bay Coast Railroad, there's two orange tracks that actually serve the Wallops Island facility. They're under lease right now to one of the rock providers that's bringing in all of the ballast rock that's necessary in order for the construction over at that location. But as well as that, Coastline Chemical Company, which is right next door, had been using those tracks but had been displaced from them for rail use because of the fact that Wallops was taking off. No pun intended. The proposed spur track will help solidify Coastal Chemical by having its own dedicated track at the cost of about $365,400. As a part of this, Coastal Chemical also wants to double the size of its manufacturing processes that they provide at this location. The project is served by the Bay Coast Railroad, which is one of our short line railroads, which actually floats cars across the Chesapeake Bay on a barge. That's a little bit of a different view to see 21 rail cars on a flat barge that are floating across Chesapeake Bay, but that's how they bring the service over from the Virginia Beach area. In addition to that, this project will add 75 additional cars, which is double the size of the facility's throughput by rail. It's a $2.6 million investment. As I said, they are also doubling the size of their facility that they use to process their glycol alcohol, as well as it's a $430,800 rail construction cost. 12 new jobs are associated with this expansion. It does qualify under our evaluation criteria, which was adopted by the board, so it meets that criteria to go forward with a recommendation. little bit about Coastal Chemical. Since 1999, they've been at this facility. They originally started as a chemical brokering company. Then they became a chemical processor. Their mainstay at this location is the processing of glycol alcohol, better known in a common term as antifreeze for your automobile. In this, they bring the glycol in high concentration. They cut it with water, and then they blow plastic bottles, which they will also bring those pellets in by rail on site, which these blowing plants have become very portable and mobile. So they can blow, fill, and bring all of the raw materials in by rail. Rail access is a vital expansion to the project, as I just described. Both their raw materials for both the bottles and for the rail car, the glycol alcohol, will all come in by rail. In summary, for the fiscal year allocation, this will be our first rail access economic development project for the year upcoming, so you'll hit the ground running, so to speak. We'll have a $365,400 grant application that would be heard by the board next month. This is a 30-day pre-briefing. This does require a cash local match, which is being provided by Coastal at $65,400. Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to turn the floor back over to you for any questions you may have.
Any questions for Space?
In light of the task force that we ever set up after the Lynchburg catastrophe, is this falling? Is anybody looking at this potential?
I don't think so. In other words, in terms of what the question is, whether it would be incongruent with what we're doing with the task force. No, I think so. This again is a it meets the criteria of the program. At the task force, what we're really being charged with is, as you know, federal authorities mainly have most of the oversight. The main thing we're looking for is what's in the cars, so that if a mishap does happen, our first responders know what they're dealing with. So I don't think so. I don't think this has any issue. Any issues with the task force.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. I voted on tomorrow, too. So I think that concludes all the things we'll be voting on tomorrow. We have the governor released this past week a product that VDOT had developed called the Virginia Roads. And depending on where we thought we would get to today, it looks like we do have time. And Mr. Kilpatrick, who is a technical wizard, is going to show us how to is going to show us how to use this, because he told me any idiot could use it. He said even me. So Mr. Kilpatrick, going to turn it over, and we'll get this going.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to ask our CIO, Morali Rao, to come up. He's going to talk here about this great product, but. This thing is fairly Charlie-proof. They gave it to me some months ago, and I took my best efforts to break it. And while I maybe succeeded in early versions, they quickly outsmarted me. This product, again, was announced by the governor, and it's a evolution of some of the things that we've done at VDOT in terms of providing information to the public. As you know, so much of what we do is geographic-based, it's map-based, it's a particular spot in a particular place, so a mapping system is so valuable to what we do. So what I want to do now is ask Morali to, we're gonna take you on a flight through this, and you also should have on your desktop the ability to pull it up also, but he's going to go through what it is, the basis of it, and also some things moving forward. It was just launched a week ago, and we already have found some additional things that we want to add in the future. So with that, Morali, please take control.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. This is a live demo, and we have tested it. There's a lot of social media chatter already, so I know it works. I'm hoping it's going to work today. What we have done is to collect all sorts of VDOT data and VDOT information. That's some are new, some are pre-existing in different locations, but all of them are brought together in a one-stop shop portal launch. In your desktop, we have a Chrome icon. If you click on the Chrome icon at the bottom, it'll launch the the Virginia roads for you, and I'll walk you through how it looks here. Basically, it's the modern smartphone technology approach. It's called iconization, where all applications are launched through icon-based approach. So if you click on all, you'll see a list of all available map products of VDOT data, whether it's on projects or pavements or various types of construction details. In the interest of time, I want to walk you through just the first two, the projects in our 6-year improvement program and the pavement conditions as we speak today as such. So if you click on the projects icon as such, it takes a few seconds to load, but these are all the mappable projects in our current 6-year program as such. If you can see on the left panel, you can sort the projects based on project type, county, and various other level details. And on the top row, you can see the filters. You can see the map, the varies. Or you can go to the cluster map, the list, and the overview as such. If you look at the color scheme, the red color is for future projects. These are all projects that are in the 6-year program that's very in the early stages of study, in the development process. No design work underway. Estimates and schedules are at planning level. If you look at the green, it's design underway, project in development process. Design work underway, estimates and schedules are being refined as we speak. The next one is the advertised. Project has been advertised for construction, but no work has yet started on the ground. The next icon is the construction started, that means contracts are awarded and the work is really going on as we speak. And the next one is called the construction started, that means completed, means within the last 12 months, the project has been completed and is open for traffic. We decided to keep for the last 12 months because if you just keep it for the last 10, 20 years, all of them will look blue as such. So we decided for presentation perspectives. So if you look at all the projects, I'll walk you through the cluster map approach. Here it tells you just as a sort of in various locations, what kind of projects that are there, in what status of the development as such. You can see various levels of details underneath those things. If you are used to a traditional list approach, you can go through the list of all the projects and go through an Excel spreadsheet type of perspectives as such. So going back to the projects, I'm going to walk you through one project that the commissioner highlighted. This is the project, if you click on the details, it takes a few seconds to load. This is design underway in Hampton Roads on I-64 capacity improvements that the commissioner talked about in his presentation. If you click on the dashboard icon, it gives you the current status of the project as it is displayed on our construction dashboard. It's the same data, but presented in a dashboard format as such. As you can see, all the status is green and on the dashboard as such here. And if you want, you can go back and see, if you want to see how the current traffic camps looks like, it connects live to the traffic camps where available. This is part of our 511 travel information program, and this is a live shot of the existing roadways as we speak as such.
So this is, Morales given this example here. This is a future project, I-64 widening in Hampton Roads, critical project in the Hampton Roads region. Again, as it's describing it, you can go in and pull information from our VDOT dashboard, which gives the status of the project. It gives these sites will also, in some cases, provide renderings, photographs. And as we continue to build this system more robustly, there'll be more and more detail of these projects. In some cases, we have even driven the project, so you can go in and capture the video. This is the first time that we have externally projected in a map-based format the projects that we're delivering throughout the Commonwealth. So it's an example of being able to get the information out to the public. So all construction and maintenance projects will be populated in this system. And each day we're getting better about data cleanup, cleaning up some of the details, and that'll be an ongoing process in pushing this information out.
But as you can see, you might be able to see that not all projects in our six-year program are mappable, because there are some county-wide or district-wide projects that are just not easy to present on a map as such. I want to walk you through the other major items that we have done, and that's in the pavement program. This will give you a view of all the pavement status in the state as such.
So if you click on the home button again up in the top, and then click on the all, that'll bring up all of the icons again, and then you can click on the orange one that says pavement condition and paving schedule. So again, if you click on the home icon across the top bar, and then you click on the all button, that'll list all the icons again, and then you'll see the green, see the orange pavement condition and paving schedule.
That's it, yeah. So if you are on the pavement page as such, you'll see on the top there is some legends that if you see lots of blues, that means the current condition as we speak today is excellent. And then you have lots of greens that are good, fair, poor, very poor, and some of them are not rated. And you see another icon called hash marks. That's where the current paving activities are going on as we speak. So this is a very citizen-centric application. So the people can just simply type in, as an example, New Kent. Just New Kent County. It'll zoom to the New Kent County. You can zoom into this and see, oh, there is a project that's here. It has got a L of fair rating, and it says it's a hash mark, so that it means that some paving activity is scheduled. What is the activity? So you can go down and see. It's in New Kent County in Richmond District on I-64 eastbound, mile marker 211.53 to 219, and it's a plant mix known as the repaving project as such. So you can see the not only the condition of the pavement, where it's located, also what's scheduled to be worked on it as such. And that level of detail is available for all projects related to pavement in this website.
Now this is another area. If you remember what the chief engineer mentioned, that on the secondary system we rate the pavement 20% of a county each year. So once every 5 years, theoretically, you will have rated the entire county. But it is a random sampling. So it may not show every road in the state, every state-maintained road. Again, we're continually trying to populate this. It's also accurate to about, again, the example is if we pave a road this year or today, it may not show up on the pavement rating for almost a year. So again, that's part of the check that has to go on in looking at this and evaluating the data. But what it also does do is a citizen can now go and look at a stretch of roadway and say, well, what do they think the condition of my roadway is, and is it on the paving schedule? And so that information is contained here. There's going to continue to be need for data cleanup on this. It's such an enormous system, and again, our folks put this together and launched it over about the last 4 months.
You can enter a zip code.
Mr. Top?
Is this to supplement the 511 website, or is
this? It's actually, if you back out again, hit the home button again, and click all, you'll notice there is actually a 511 icon. So we have a lot of map-based systems. Now, over the years, most of our map-based systems have been internal-facing. We've used them for various tools. This is the first time that we've collected them and projected them out in sort of an easy way. So 511 is here. Snow maps are here. things like for our trucking companies, truck routes are now projected out here. And really, with much as anything, what this did is bring them all together. So if you want to go to the 511 system, you click the 511 icon, and it takes you right into that site. And I think that Morale, there's some other things that we're looking at, and maybe you can talk about some other maps that we look at adding pretty soon.
The thing that the commissioner mentioned a few minutes ago is that the data gets updated nightly, weekly, monthly, on a regular basis, depending on what kind of information you're looking for. I know that as we speak, in the next few weeks, we are working this to release it in a mobile-compatible, tablet-compatible approach. That's been a lot of chatter in Twitter over the last 48 hours as to how to make it mobile-compliant as such. We're also going to be adding bridge conditions that the chief engineer talked about. We'll be talking about crash and accident locations. We'll be adding traffic volumes at different locations and things of that nature. And we have a relatively active group of people in the community that are using social media to give us good feedback as such. So this is the presentation that we had, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
In Morale, about almost 3 years ago, we launched the 511 app on Android and iPhone. And at the time, we were one of only less than a handful of states that had done that. This was developed in-house by Morale and his resources, working with units throughout the state, the experts that create these things. Are we aware of any state that has actually created a consolidated tool like this?
Very few people are moving into this thing called iconization of the public data. Very few people are there. There are maps available for projects. There are maps available for pavement conditions, not in a comprehensive way like this. As such.
And this goes along with Governor McAuliffe's campaigning on more transparency in government. You know, we've gone to streaming our sessions here. So this is a belief that the more transparent you are, the better accountable, the better decisions will be made. And so this is a good tool. I mean, it's got snow maps. You can look on here and find out what the snow plows are. In addition to being good information, it also hopefully will lessen the burden on some of our emergency calls as we just take a look right here and see what's going on. So it seems to be a win-win for both the public and for the department. It's one of the things that we're dealing with now. Some of our laws are not up to speed, and you've seen the paper what we're dealing with Uber and Lyft, and that doesn't really affect us particularly. But it's indicative of how we should be using technology as the world continues to advance. We've got to keep up with it.
Yes, just one question, Mr. Chairman. What is the structure exclusion map? What do you?
Structure exclusion map. Let me take a look here, make sure I know which one it is. This is probably, I don't even know, Gary, I think this is a map that of structure, of restricted structures, bridge structures.
We post this information for Department of Motor Vehicles to use for their hauling permit program.
This is an example of a very useful tool, not just for DMV, but also for trucking companies as they look at restricted bridge structures.
Thank you.
Scott, so how are you feeding content? Who's updating
it? The Virginia Roads portal content is dynamically received. No one is entering the data into Virginia Roads because of the for example, the project. We have a set of construction management and program management projects like the 16 improvement program, the integrated project management system, project pool. All of them feed a nightly to our nightly data warehouse. We go through a data validation process and then it's posted up in the morning. So most of the data is updated on a regular basis. We have a pavement program that has a regular pavement condition program on an annual basis. We upload the data and things like that. So different data points have different latency approach for that. But it's whatever latest information we have is presented here. Nobody's entering the data into portals.
Right, just aggregating it. So
that's correct.
Are you getting from the NPOs or are they involved in this?
Not at this point. Except for the two maps that we talked about, the projects and the pavement condition, those are new for VDOT. Those are in terms of things that we didn't have before this was done. We did not have map-based. The pavement management people have map-based systems, but they're, I'll call them, highly technical things that they understand very well. But even for other folks within the agency, it's difficult to follow. In terms of the project, we did not have a consolidated map-based project system. All of the information has been out there in various systems, but to be able to look at it in a map format or a map as a source, this is really the first time we've been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Tom?
The only suggestion that sticks out to me is there's no icon for the Easy Pass system. That
there, in terms of, and this is, you know, one of the things I think that we will continue to add things. And while there's a map for toll facilities, there's not the potential to use this as Morali calls it, iconization. That you could have, this is called Virginia Roads, and right now we're thinking maps, but it could just as easily be an icon. You click Easy Pass, and it throws you to the Easy Pass website. So this is a different way, you know, we're used to using a kind of, I'll call it a website as our mentality now, but especially as you get into more mobile uses, the ability for people to, instead of where's Easy Pass, there's your Easy Pass icon, and click on it, and there you go to your site. So that's a great suggestion. We're not sure what all the things that we're going to add here in the future. That's a great suggestion.
Okay, Molly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We wanted just you guys to understand, because it was a press release, in case you got questions on it, you know what was going on. That is all we had on the agenda for today. We will move into, we cannot move into the action items because it was at the publicized meeting, the public comment, and that will begin tomorrow morning at 8:30. Now, you have a couple things in your package. In fact, this is the first time I've ever seen this. You have the new Virginia maps. In fact, your name's on it. So it's actually correct. I mean, everybody in here is actually correct, which is the first time I think I've been on the CTV. At any point in time, it was actually right. So thank you, VDOT, for getting these out. I should also mention Mr. Tom has been reappointed by Governor McCullough, and so we welcome her continuing on the board. Now, tomorrow's schedule will start at 8:30. I don't know how much public comment we will have. I suspect we will have some. Because of the six-year plan, there's a project in Northern Virginia we're awarding that I know at least two legislators are going to come on either side of the project in debate. I've told them I will give them as much time as they need to persuade you. I was not going to pull it out of the program based on the recommendation, but if they wanted to come talk to you, that'd be great. And of course, we have Route 29. I've been getting, as we said here, I've gotten over 50 emails, mostly counteracting the letter campaign I had last week that was working in that regard. So I'm sure we'll have some topics on that. The reason I bring that up is the Governor McCullough would like to address us before we actually take the action items. So what we'll probably do tomorrow is to begin public comment. If it's not completed by 10 and when he is scheduled to speak, then we will stop public comment, allow the governor to speak. If we have finished public comment, we'll do everything on the agenda we can until 10 o'clock, let the governor speak, and then we will take the remaining action items
on the agenda. So that's what the, we'll be doing tomorrow. Is the dress? What's the dress tonight, Carol?
Casual. Okay. So
great, because I'm in no ties. So it's at 6 o'clock, and you want to tell them what you've got lined up, Carol? And then tomorrow we will begin at 8:30. Now, before we break, is there anything, we'll have a chance to speak this evening, but is there anything particularly the board would like to bring up, discuss, or? All right, between cocktail hour? Okay, so we'll do it over cocktail hour. So thanks everybody for coming. This will adjourn the workshop session. And we'll meet again at 6 o'clock at the boathouse.